Nick Abbott.
It'll never get written. Ian, tonight we are talking about parents who are skipping meals to buy branded school uniforms. We'll hear about Tory MPs who are bewailing the state of their own party's publicity. More children are watching pornography accidentally, so they say. We'll hear about that and what effect the Online Harm Act has had. We'll check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there, hear about Trump's refusal to send American troops to be a peacekeeping force in the event that the Ukraine war comes to an end. But first, Labour's own policies are causing it grief. It's all self-inflicted wounds. That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the High Court has ruled a council in Essex no longer has to house asylum seekers at a local hotel. Epping Forest District Council claimed public safety was being put at risk because of the ongoing protests outside the Bell. It will mean people staying there will have to leave before the 12th of September. But Steve Smith from Care for Calais is concerned this will be a victory for violent disorder.
We know them to be victims of war, torture, persecution, conflict. And to put them in a position like this where they're under threat is absolutely abysmal. It makes you think, where's the compassion? Where's the kindness? Where's the decency? If violent disorder works here, where does it stop?
Donald Trump's ruled out sending US troops to Ukraine as part of any security guarantee. That's despite saying yesterday that America would be involved in future protection for Kyiv. LBC's Washington correspondent Simon Marks says it's bad news for Keir Starmer and other allies of Ukraine.
As the Prime Minister and his European colleagues were still hoping they made progress pulling Donald Trump out of Vladimir Putin's orbit, the President took to Fox News and made it clear their mission had largely failed. He falsely accused Ukraine of starting the war and indicated he's backing Putin's ambitions to take the whole of eastern Ukraine.
The government is reportedly considering whether to make major changes to stamp duty in England and Northern Ireland. Under the proposals, it would see the levy transferred to some sellers rather than buyers. It would apply to homes worth more than £500,000. Estate agent Nick Stoppard has told LBC he thinks these changes would be good for the economy.
There is a lot of money tied up within property that people have gained huge amounts of value in, and the people that are ultimately paying the tax are a lot of first-time buyers and a lot of people who are having to pay stamp duty to effectively stop renting.
England's Children's Commissioner is calling for the closing of loopholes online, with some children as young as six reporting seeing adult content. The government insists the Online Safety Act will address concerns. And the remnants of Hurricane Erin could be hitting the UK by the bank holiday. Forecasters say conditions will turn unsettled with rain and blustery winds on the way for Sunday night. In the city, the FTSE 100 has closed up 31 points at 91.89. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather. A cloudy start for many tomorrow, becoming sunnier in the afternoon, especially in the southwest and northwest, a high of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. Most Labour members oppose Keir Starmer's ban on Palestine action, a poll has found. More than 7 in 10 paid-up Labour supporters said Starmer and Cooper, the Home Secretary, were wrong to proscribe the group last month. Palestine action was banned by the government on July the 1st, meaning that membership and support of the organisation, including funding, can carry sentences of up to 14 years in prison. Let's talk about this with Aubrey Allegretti. Aubrey is the chief political correspondent at The Times and joins us on the phone now. Hello, Aubrey.
Good evening, Nick.
Starmer's got himself in a right hole on this, hasn't he? He's out of step with his own party, with his own MPs and with the country at large, and yet he keeps digging. Does it seem like he thinks he can just tough it out and that it will go away?
Well, I suppose there are a few things to unpick there. I mean, certainly it is true that some Labour MPs are uncomfortable with the government's decision to prescribe and therefore ban Palestine action. We saw a handful of them, I think it was no more than a dozen, vote against that move just before the summer recess. And then you have the question of Labour members who are certainly more, let's say, to the left of Labour than the parliamentary party. And as you were talking about there, it was 71% who said it was wrong for the government to have prescribed the group. Now, Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, has effectively said that there is due cause for this, that there are things that we don't know, and that this was done on the basis of security advice provided by the intelligence services, but we haven't had a sort of very full picture of what that advice is. We've heard snippets from the government, Keir Starmer telling Labour's ruling National Executive Committee just before the summer recess as well that there were other instances of Palestine action targeting Jewish-owned businesses who didn't necessarily have a sort of explicit link to Israel or Israeli arms manufacturers, which Palestine Action said that they were targeting before. But it is certainly a sort of messy and convoluted picture for the government.
Yeah, I mean, Starmer can't have expected so many people to risk arrest, can he? And now that they have, he's looking like a bit of a twit. He's responsible for arresting pensioners, disabled people, nurses, hundreds of peaceful demonstrators who just want an end to the killing that this government is connected to by dint of arming the Israelis and providing intelligence and so on to their army. I mean, they only cancelled 30 out of 350 arms export licences to Israel. Or cancelled is not the right word. They were suspended, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, the government sources I spoke to when this sort of issue was really rearing its head over the last few weeks said they wanted to appear tough on law and order. They were concerned about the potential for further civil unrest this summer against the backdrop of protests, particularly outside migrant hotels. And they were concerned that there would be accusations of two-tier policing, that people might look soft touch if they didn't take a consistent approach in arresting protesters suppressing their expressing their support for Palestine Action. I suppose what the problem is that people are sort of actually, they're not necessarily showing their support for Palestine Action per se. What they're doing is rather more nuanced than that. In some cases, they are basically expressing their dissatisfaction at the decision to prescribe Palestine Action in the first place. And there is a difference there. But ultimately, it does lead to images of hundreds of pensioners being arrested in Parliament Square and the potential for further demonstrations to be held, because this isn't a sort of process the government can easily go back on. It's not going to turn around a few weeks later and say, OK, we're going to unprescribe this group. It's just sort of uncomfortable sitting while the government is trying to say that it is supporting Palestine to move towards a two-state solution.
Yeah, I've heard that phrase two-tier policing a lot, and it appears that we actually do have two-tier policing, but not in the way that Farage says. A man was arrested, as you probably know, wearing a T-shirt that looked like Palestine Action logo, but actually said Plasticine Action. While the police in the same country ignored a man holding a banner outside a hotel housing asylum seekers that read, "Kill them all." And another man was arrested for holding up a joke from an issue of Private Eye. So joking is illegal, and calling for mass murder is totally fine. I mean, this, a lawyer has made the law in this country a laughingstock.
It is an issue that politicians will have to bear some responsibility for. I mean, they can say it's up to the police and these are operational decisions, but ultimately it was a sort of government decision to prescribe Palestine Action, albeit, they say, on the advice of intelligence services as well. I think in the case of the man wearing the T-shirt, he's since admitted that it was designed to be a sort of easy mistake to make, but it does show the sort of blurred lines, if you like, that the police are trying to tread when it comes to how to enforce this. If it's a sort of deliberate, you know, play on words, if you like, then how are they supposed to enforce those rules? It is messy, and that's probably why there are different examples of policing decisions coming out across the country.
Yeah, why do you think the police are acting like that? Are they acting on orders from Number 10? Because it seems unlikely that they would be spending so much time that they haven't got suppressing free speech unless Starmer assumed he could simply shut down dissent by arresting everyone.
Well, I don't think the police necessarily act on the instructions of Number 10. I mean, to a certain extent, they are pressured and work on advice given to them by the Home Secretary. But what they ultimately say is that they're following the law, and that is passed by MPs and the House of Lords as well. And in the case of things that don't need to be voted on, you know, directives from the government per se. But the police have certainly had quite a difficult job this summer. They were obviously accused by Nigel Farage of bussing in, you know, counter-protesters to some of the anti-migrant hotel demos, and then that claim had to be corrected when it turned out it wasn't right. So there's a lot of sort of information and misinformation and disinformation swirling around. They've obviously had a very busy summer. Lots of the forces have had to cancel leave because there's been so much sort of pressure on resources, but it has been a very difficult summer. I think Keir Starmer has probably gone back onto his holiday today, having returned from the US, hopeful that there won't be another sort of outbreak of unrest and violence on the scale that we saw last summer.
Yeah, and whatever you might think about the issues of Palestine, the stance that Starmer has taken is politically inept, isn't it? Staggeringly so.
In the sense that I think he is struggling to tell clearly the government's view on Palestine. I think that's probably true. He's obviously evolved his position quite significantly since the very infamous LBC interview, where he was effectively asked whether it was right for Israel to be able to withhold food and water from Palestinians, and sort of tacitly seemed to agree with it or answered that it was. And he later said that he was talking about something else, but obviously that clip in itself went viral, and he sort of suffered a lot for Labour's stance on Palestine. He's then moved the government into a position very recently where he said he would support a sort of two-state solution for Palestine, but we're yet to sort of fully see the details or understand exactly how the UK is actually intent on bringing the conflict to an end beyond just recognising Palestinian statehood. And so, yes, the backdrop of banning a group which is called Palestine Action and which explicitly supports some of the aims that Keir Starmer says he does himself, that is quite murky.
Good to talk to you, Aubrey. Thanks for that. Aubrey Allegretti, Chief Political Correspondent at The Times. Let's talk about related issues with Chris Anous. Chris is the Research Associate at More in Common, who have done polling on Starmer's policies. Hello, Chris. Nope.
Chris? Hi, Nick.
Ah, there you are. So what has your polling... Yes, what has your polling gleaned, Chris? No, not there. Okay, well, see if we can get him. Take a short break, then we'll come back. LBC.
This is LBC. Mr. Thing is enjoying a lovely summer's day. He's trimmed the hedge, he's cut the grass, and best of all, he's just had 25% snipped off his home care cover, meaning his boiler, electrics, plumbing and drains are now covered for less. Chop, chop, sign up today. This offer ends soon. Search British Gas Home Care Cover. Watch out for that rake, Mr. Thing. Ouch! Too late. British Gas. Taking care of things. T's and C's apply. Offer not available to existing home care or boiler service contract customers. Ends 9th of September 2025.
We know that you're always looking for an excuse to host a barbecue. If you need another reason, there's a £3 for £12 offer on a range of delicious barbecue food online or at your local Waitrose. You'll be spoiled for choice with succulent soy and tamarind chicken kebabs, juicy pork chorizo and manchego burgers, or king prawn kebabs dressed in a vibrant soy, lime and honey glaze. All you've got to do now is decide who to invite. Let your summer side out with Waitrose. Selected lines and stores subject to availability. Minimum online spend and delivery charges apply.
At TfO, we're opening up more of London for everyone with step-free access. We're continuing to improve accessibility at many of our stations, and now over 200 stations and counting have step-free access, including the entire Elizabeth Line, DLR and all tram stops. That is how we're making the greener way to travel more accessible to all. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So hopefully Chris Anous is joining us now. Chris is the Research Associate at More in Common, who have done polling on Keir Starmer's policies. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Nick. Can you hear me?
Yes, very good of you to join us. So what has your polling gleaned?
Yeah, I think Keir Starmer has a real challenge, the Labour Party does, more broadly, because what we found, I mean, you've been doing a regular bit of a tracker over the last year to test two things. First of all, the awareness of policies. So which policies did the British public know about? What have they heard about? And then second of all, the favourability of those policies. So which policies do they see as reflecting positively in the government and which do they see as reflecting negatively? And what we found is that the policies that are well known are actually the unpopular ones. And actually the government's got lots of popular policies that very few Britons are familiar with.
Yeah, that has echoes of Jeremy Corbyn's manifesto. I can remember taking a lot of calls from people at the time when he was the leader, saying that they were furious with him and didn't agree with a single thing he said. And then I'd read some of his manifesto and they agreed with all of the points. So it's a comms problem, isn't it? Communications.
I think to a certain extent, yes. And I think, you know, what we found as COP3 particularly negatively has been the winter fuel allowance. Payments. So the government's decision to cut those is not only the most well-known policy of this government, but also the most negatively received policy. And I think what happened was, towards the start of the government's time in government, there was a lack of a narrative from the government about why it was making these tough choices. And in the absence of that, it came across to the public that actually, you know, the government was just choosing groups of Britons to pick on, and often choosing very popular groups of Britons to pick on, whether that be pensioners or farmers or small businesses. So in this, in the absence of like a wider narrative and a wider purpose, you know, it didn't really land very well with the public.
And how much do you think that that is a function of the right-wing press who have been piling on from the moment that he got his knees under the desk at number 10?
I think, you know... That's a good question, but I think really to attribute it solely to that, I think would be missing a bit the big picture in that, you know, these aren't issues where the British public are misinformed on. You know, they do know a lot about the pensions policy and disability payments and the farmers tax, and that's something that really did cut through with them. So I think from the negative side, you know, you can't really attribute that just to the right-wing media. I guess where the challenge from Keir Starmer has come from in navigating the media is how does he land the more positive policies that he's been doing. So I'll give you an example. One of the most popular policies the government's got has actually been its plans to abolish Ofwat and to replace it with a stronger regulator. That's also one of its least well-known policies. So I guess from the government's perspective, it's how does it navigate that media environment and ensure that actually the positive story it's got to say is also getting out there, as well as the tough decisions it's having to make.
Yeah, unlike the Tories and Farage, he doesn't really have much of the media on his side, does he? So how can the Labour Party actually communicate some of the things that people would like if only they knew about them?
Well, increasingly Britons are getting their news from social media and directly from politicians. And, you know, one criticism or improvement perhaps the government could make is, you know, focusing on that environment and to get its media out more clearly on social media, because increasingly Britons aren't getting their news from traditional news sources. They're getting it from Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. And, you know, if the government is struggling to get it into some of its message in the more mainstream media, going directly to the public is increasingly an effective option.
Particularly, I imagine, as the age demographic of traditional media, newspapers, is increasingly old, and as you get older, you're less likely to want to vote for a centre-left party.
Yeah, I mean, both of those things are true, but increasingly, actually, it's Britons of all ages who are getting the news from social media. So it's not, you know, perhaps 10, 15 years ago, it was a real... we were in a position where if you wanted to reach get stuff out on social media, you'd really be predominantly reaching young people. You know, increasingly, whether it be people in their 50s or 60s or even some, you know, age 70 and above, they're actually increasingly getting news from media. So it's not just the case of young people. There's a real opportunity for the government there, if it can land its messages on social media, to reach all types of Britons.
What about the personalities in the government? Have you done any polling on them?
Yeah, actually, we asked the Britons last weekend which of sort of senior Labour figures do they think could do a better job than Keir Starmer. And broadly, perhaps because of low name recognition, don't know or not sure was actually one of the dominant responses. The only person who did actually outperform Keir Starmer was Andy Burnham. And I think perhaps there's an element there of, you know, being an outside voice from this government, he's been able to be more clear and to be stronger in his disagreements in some of the tougher decisions that the government has to make.
What about Ed Miliband?
I think people's opinions to Ed Miliband have warmed a lot since he was the Labour leader, because I think there he struggled really in the way that Keir Starmer perhaps has had challenges to, you know, develop that clear and positive you know, credibility and a reason to why people might vote for him. He's in line with the rest of the cabinet in terms of being actually, you know, he's not polling particularly negatively. So, yeah, he's broadly in line with Keir Starmer and the rest of the cabinet.
And has your polling shown the level of support that a party led by Jeremy Corbyn might expect to enjoy?
Yes, so we asked about that. So at this point, it's still hard to poll because it's a hypothetical party without a name. But when we did ask about it, we found that they'd probably get about 10% of the poll of the support in our poll. But you know, there's a huge amount of uncertainty with that, given that A, the party's not launched, B, it's not got a name, and C, people are still to sort of, you know, form their opinions. But there is a real section of the British public that perhaps is frustrated with the lack of change that the Labour Party has got done, and sort of wants to channel that in that anti-system and lack of confidence into more leftward direction in comparison to the more rightward direction of those backing reform.
10% is quite a remarkable figure for a party that doesn't even exist yet.
No, but increasingly in our fragmented political system, that 10% could be pivotal. So, you know, Reform are currently 9% ahead in our latest polls, and that's only on 30%, because Britain's, you know, the British public have become so fragmented in terms of who they're voting for. And, you know, what we're saying and suggest is, you know, there's little chance that on sort of 10% that Jeremy Corbyn could be entering Downing Street anytime soon. But what is important is, you know, yes, he may win a handful of constituencies, his own in Islington and other parts of the country, which are more progressive and more left-wing. But importantly, he could have a real effect, and his party could have a real effect in the Labour to Reform marginals that are going to dominate the next election. Because, you know, we have his support primarily coming from the Labour Party and the Green Party. So if those Labour voters in those seats aren't voting for Labour and vote for Jeremy Corbyn's party, then the real risk that sort of dozens of seats could be handed directly to Reform.
And I'm going to be talking about the Conservative Party a little bit later. Are they becoming the third party?
So in our polls nationally, we have Reform ahead on about 30%, and then the Labour Party and Conservative Party neck on neck on 21 or 22% roughly. So it's, you know, within the margin of error within each other. But the challenge that the Conservatives have, as you know, the political system lies and voting patterns lies, they do, is that the Reform are taking a huge chunk of their existing voters. So from 2019 to 2024, about a quarter of those voters, Conservative voters, are now going to Reform. And that means that actually the Conservative parties could be a real losers of the first past the post system. So in our latest projection, so we did a projection of constituency by constituency, we actually had the Conservatives in a close battle with the Liberal Democrats for third and fourth. So, very close, not only to being third party, but also actually being fourth party.
And back to Labour, did you get a sense of, you know, talking to people on the doorstep, what it is that they want most of all from this Labour Party? Is there something that they had in mind when they voted for them that hasn't actually come about?
Well, in one word, Nick, it's probably change, because, you know, the public voted for change. Keir Starmer made a big deal, big emphasis on offering change, and they don't feel that change has happened. Ultimately, the key test for the government in the next election is, has the government taken the policies and decisions and measures to make our lives better? And if they have, you know, have I started feeling that? Or do I trust that I'll start feeling that in the next few years? Because ultimately, Britons have had a very tough time, as I'm sure you know, since the financial crisis. And they're looking for change. They're looking for some improvement. And where perhaps in the old politics of two parties, the government, incumbent government, to say, look, you know, you may not like us, but trust me, the other guys are just as bad as us. In reform now, the new kids on the block. So simply saying we're not the Conservatives and we're not as bad as them is not enough. So I think the government really needs to persuade Britons, and our polling and focus group conversations reveal this, that actually they're capable of delivering change and they're capable of delivering improvements to Britain's everyday lives.
Very good to talk to you, Chris. Excuse me. Very good to talk to you, Chris. Thanks very much for that. That's Chris Anous, Research Associate at More in Common, who have done polling on Keir Starmer's policies. So what do you make of that? I mean, they're on their holidays at the moment. I'm sure they're thinking very strongly about what it is that they're going to be delivering to us when they get back. What would you like to hear them say when that happens? Because there's a lot of unpicking they're going to have to do, and that Palestine action policy does seem to be an odd one, particularly as you can get away with holding up a sign that says kill them all in reference to the people inside an asylum hotel, but you cannot get away with holding up a joke from Private Eye. I don't really recognise that as being what this country is about. And yet, Keir Starmer, does seem to be digging himself in deeper by appearing to want to arrest his way out of it, almost bludgeon people into accepting it. And, you know, we aren't the only one that that finds a problem with the with that policy. The United Nations also do. The Human Rights Commission said that the government's decision to proscribe Palestine Action Protest Group under terrorism legislation raises serious concerns that counter-terrorism laws are being applied to conduct that is not terrorist in nature and risks hindering the legitimate exercise of fundamental freedoms across the UK. That's the UN Human Rights Chief, Volker Türk. That was him speaking. And it does seem as though it's using a mallet to crack a nut. And yet, having made that decision, Keir Starmer seems to be intent on sticking to his guns in that regard. So what do you make of that? And what do you make of the sort of misfiring so far? It might be a kind way of putting it, that they don't really seem to have found their feet. They seem to be off balance almost the entire time, apart from abroad. Seems to have come through with flying colours in pretty much everything that he's done abroad. Perhaps he would be best advised not to come back, assuming that he is taking a foreign holiday. I don't think he is, actually. He's in Scotland, isn't he? But it's not a recipe for success. You can't win an election on being popular for what you do abroad. You have to be popular here. And some of the things they've been doing are very good, but people just don't know about them, which is different to the Conservatives. You might say that it's the other way around. The Tories used to be, certainly when Boris Johnson was in power, they used to be very successful in hogging the limelight, in persuading us that they were doing tremendous things, while actually your eyes and ears, all of your experience, was telling you the contrary. But they just kept pounding the message that we are the party that can, and now they're saying that we are the party that can fix the problems that we caused in the first place. They wouldn't put it that way, but that's essentially what they're offering. 0345 6060 973. We are less than 2 weeks away from Parliament's return. God, it's happened so fast. The football season is on us as well. Summer is coming to an end. It's slipping through our fingers. So when they do return, are you expecting more of the same? Or are you still holding out for Keir Starmer to deliver change? Is there any indication that that is a possibility? 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850. Email nick a chat@lbc.co.uk. If you're on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060973. Couple of texts on Palestine action. Michaela in Hebden Bridge says, back in the 1960s, CND was the protest group of the moment. They had two offshoots, Spies for Peace and the Committee of 100. They staged sit-ins on Air Force runways and broke into a nuclear bunker. CND didn't get banned as a result of their actions. And Will texts, a lack of information from the government will be creating assumptions and conspiracy theories. Cooper would not say what intelligence body recommended a Palestine action be branded a terrorist group. Yeah, there's this talk of they know things that we don't know, which is doesn't really do the government any good, because if we don't know them, then we can't make a judgment as to whether we agree with it or not. So we just ignore whatever it is that they are referring to, being as how we don't, they won't tell us. 0345 6060973. After the break, we're taking your calls on this and speaking to LBC's Washington correspondent to get the latest on Donald Trump's meeting with Zelensky after rolling out the red carpet for Putin. The time is 10:30. The news headlines with Daryl Jackson.
A council in Essex has been granted a temporary injunction to block asylum seekers being housed in a hotel in Epping. There's been ongoing protests outside the Bell, and the district council has concerns about the risk to public safety. Donald Trump's suggested American jets could help defend Ukraine if there's a deal to end the war. But the president's ruled out sending troops as part of the security guarantees after telling reporters the US will be involved in peacekeeping. A man who was driving 140 miles an hour in a 40 zone in North London has admitted killing a woman in a crash on Christmas Day. 32-year-old Evan Ford from Bedford was behind the wheel of a Mercedes which hit the back of a BMW in Brent Cross in 2022. LBC weather, cloudy tonight across much of England and later in northern Wales too. Clearer for southwest England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, a low of 6 degrees.
LBC.
At This Vet, me as the owner, surgeon, rota manager and puppy wrangler. And now she and her team are cybersecurity experts too.
Mia, someone tried accessing our system. Phishing scam. I blocked it.
BT Security Awareness Training turns your team into your first line of defence. Quick to set up from just £1.25 per user per month. Cybersecurity is everyone's business. Thankfully, not just Mia's. Search BT Business Cybersecurity. TNCs apply. Prices exclude VAT at 20%. 12-month minimum term applies.
Have you ever wondered what becoming a lotto millionaire sounds like?
You want to sit down? I can confirm that you have won £1 million indeed.
That's Terry finding out he'd won £1 million.
Yes, oh my God.
Lotto from the National Lottery. Will you be the next millionaire? Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Who's a good human? Alex is. Because today's dog walk with Lulu the Corgi has turned into an off-grid adventure. But wherever Lulu's nose takes her, Alex will always gladly follow. That's why he also chooses Butternut Box for Lulu's meals. Freshly prepared and served straight from the fridge, helping Lulu thrive from nose to tail. Meaning one less trek for Alex, as we deliver each box straight to your door. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Yeah, back to, or back with your calls on how you think the Starmer government has done so far. I mean, they have done good things. They have done some of the things that you might expect of a Labour government, but they've had barely any publicity for them at all. What everybody has been concentrating on are the what you might call missteps. So do you think that this break, this summer break, is might offer a reset for the government? Might we kindly forget everything that's happened so far and give them a pass on that and hope for better in the future? And what is it that you think that they have done that is actually positive that should have got more publicity? And what are the things that you think that they have been mistaken in following? 0345 6060 973. Meanwhile, let's talk to Simon Marks. He is LBC's Washington correspondent, joins us on the line now. Hello, Simon.
Evening, Nick.
What developments today?
Well, Donald Trump took to his favorite television program at breakfast time, Fox and Friends, and basically used an extensive interview with that broadcast, I think, to send a message to European leaders. And the message is that if they had departed Washington, D.C. after that day-long summit at the White House with President Zelensky, thinking that they had succeeded in peeling Donald Trump away from Vladimir Putin, in dragging him out of Vladimir Putin's orbit, they needed to think again. I mean, it was an extraordinary display of the extent to which the Russian president absolutely has captured Donald Trump's viewpoint on Ukraine. And there were points during this interview in which he was literally making the history of the region up out of whole cloth. I mean, the interview is being best noted for the fact that he said there would be no American troops that will be putting their feet on Ukrainian soil as part of any security guarantees. I mean, more broadly on the issue of security guarantees, he spoke in such generic terms that I think it'd be completely impossible for any European leader to understand with any specificity what he's even thinking of committing. Take a listen to this.
There'll be some form of security. It can't be NATO, because that was that's just not something that would ever happen. They couldn't do that. So who would want that? I mean, if you were Russia, who would want to have your enemy, your opponent, sitting on your line? You don't do that.
He actually slips in that answer. The first time he says it can't be NATO because he couldn't, and then he goes, they couldn't. And he was clearly thinking about what Vladimir Putin had told him. I mean, the plan has not been for NATO alone to provide those security guarantees, but for European countries, including the UK and other NATO members, to be working with non-NATO members in providing security guarantees. But what kind of backstop he is willing to offer to meet, for example, the Prime Minister's demand that if UK troops are going to put their lives on the line, whether it's on the ground, at sea, or in the air, he wants to know that there's an American military backstop protecting them. All we got from him today was that there will be some kind of security. But more broadly, this was a president of the United States who was completely reflecting Vladimir Putin's talking points about the future of Ukraine, and actually even accused European leaders, including our own Prime Minister, of yesterday putting on a bit of a show at the White House.
Everybody can play cute and this and that, but, you know, Ukraine's going to get their life back. They're going to stop having people killed all over the place, and they're going to get a lot of land. But this was a war, and Russia is a powerful military nation, you know, whether people like it or not. It's a powerful nation. It's a much bigger nation. It's not a war that should have been started. You don't do that. You don't take on a nation that's 10 times your size. And now they're talking about Donbass, but Donbass right now, as you know, is 79% owned and controlled by Russia. So they understand what that means.
So he spoke in that interview, once again, by the way, implying that Ukraine had started the war. We're back to that falsehood. And for the first time, publicly appeared to endorse Vladimir Putin's key demand at the moment, which is that Russia needs to surrender the whole of Donbass. Ukraine needs to surrender the whole of Donbass to Russia as part of any peace process. A situation that, as Volodymyr Zelensky and the Europeans tried to point out yesterday, would leave Russian forces immediately able to leapfrog the Ukrainian defensive line that is holding them off from capturing parts of Donbass. So it'd be a huge military advantage to the Russians were Zelensky even to entertain the idea of giving Donbass away, which he clearly is not willing to do. It's also important to underscore, I mean, he made stuff up in this interview. He talked about Barack Obama having given away the Crimea to Vladimir Putin in 2014, to the point where Donald Trump described it as the worst real estate deal in history. He seems to think that there was some negotiation in 2014 whereby Obama gave Vladimir Putin the thumbs up and afforded him full control and basically sovereignty over Crimea. He doesn't even understand that his own government currently does not recognize Crimea as being Russian sovereign territory. The United States continues to recognize it as being Ukrainian sovereign territory that was illegally annexed by Vladimir Putin without, it has to be said, any particularly strong consequences from Barack Obama. But certainly Barack Obama never engaged in any kind of agreement to give it to him. It wasn't in Barack Obama's gift to give. And there were other areas of the interview where he invented history out of whole cloth, saying that any notion of Ukrainian membership of NATO had been a no-no for Russia long before Putin. Well, it wasn't a no-no for Russia. I mean, Boris Yeltsin, even in 1991, flirted with the idea of Russia joining NATO. Vladimir Putin had a conversation with Bill Clinton about joining NATO in 2017. So the point I'm making here is, what he's doing, as we've seen in so many other areas, is he's making policy based on a completely false understanding or interpretation or narrative of the facts. And for Keir Starmer and his colleagues, that's going to be monumentally complicated in the months and years ahead.
Well, there's an enormous amount to talk about from what you just said. First of which is that he said this on Fox, which is a TV station that he's suing for $1 billion. And they're still having him on.
Yes, of course. Well, I mean, his great box office. He not only was on, but he was enthusiastically advertising his appearance on Fox this morning, because I think overnight, having seen some of the commentary and having listened to what European leaders said to him yesterday, including the challenges that he received on camera from Friedrich Merz, the German Chancellor, and French President Emmanuel Macron, I think he really wanted to push back at any notion that they had succeeded in bringing him back from the dark side. This was also an interview that I think was designed to make it clear to his base that he has no intention of getting militarily embroiled in Ukraine. And he had a reason for doing that. There's a right-leaning newspaper here, very sympathetic to Trump, popular with his MAGA faithful, called the Washington Examiner. And it got terribly excited yesterday because it read into something that Trump had said during the course of his meetings at the White House, the possibility that Trump was about to announce American military involvement in providing security guarantees, which would, of course, be anathema to many of his core supporters. And I think he was determined to get on television this morning and make it absolutely clear that that is not going to happen and is not part of his thinking. But what his thinking might be on security guarantees, we have absolutely no idea, and the Europeans can't have any idea.
Yeah, to be fair to Trump, it was a part of his manifesto. He promised the American people that he was going to bring the troops home from wherever they may be. So, you know, that shouldn't come as a surprise. But he has talked in the past of some sort of security that the US might provide. And one of the things that he said, I mean, it's very difficult to know that, to actually refer back more than about 5 minutes, because you know that he would have changed his mind about 10 times in the intervening period. But he was saying a while ago that the very presence of American businesses in Ukraine would prevent Vladimir Putin's expansionist tendencies.
Yes, particularly geologists who are going to be digging up all of Ukraine's rare earths and making off with them as part of the deal that he was proposing at the time, the first deal on rare earths that was going to lead absolutely to Ukraine's extortion. Of course, the deal that was signed was considerably watered down and less pernicious than that. But he appeared to suggest at that time that the mere presence of American citizens, you know, engaged in construction or literally digging up rare earths, whatever it's going to be, Vladimir Putin would understand that there was a risk that if he went after the peacekeepers, he might, by some mistake, kill an American who was there doing business, and that would be catastrophic for Putin. I don't know why Putin would think it would be catastrophic for Putin, given that Donald Trump continues to make threats to invoke sanctions against Russia and never, ever follows through on them. He's not laid a glove on Vladimir Putin since he came into office and is clearly still completely beguiled by them. So that was one argument that he was advancing. As to what his answer is to that European demand for a backstop, I mean, the detail of this matters. I don't think European governments were imagining that American boots were going to be on the ground in Ukraine. That's never been the ask. But they do want to know that if they do come under attack, then either by the use of drones or through intelligence that is shared with them or through some kind of muscular response from the White House, Donald Trump is going to have their back. And as you and I talked about a couple of nights ago, at the heart of this is really the question of whether the Europeans and Zelensky can trust Trump. And today was yet another day when I think he demonstrated to them that they really can't, because he continues to be absolutely drawn to Vladimir Putin's approach towards Ukraine like a magnet. It's as though there's a magnetic force pulling him into the Kremlin's orbit, and he simply won't break with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting that he's talking about, NATO this and NATO that, and that's not what Putin would like. And yet, Steve Witkoff, the billionaire donor, this inept envoy that Trump has appointed because of his largesse, he said that the US would provide some sort of NATO Article 5-like security. What on earth did he mean by that?
Well, we still have no idea. I mean, as we said the other night, that phrase was gobbledygook, and the word like contained in it, Article 5-like commitments. No European leader emerged yesterday with any clear understanding of what that means, because Article 5, of course, is the mutual defence pact that lies at the heart of the NATO covenant. An attack on one is an attack on all and will lead to a potential response from NATO collectively. But what does that mean in the context of a security guarantee operation that is being mounted by European and non-European governments without any direct American involvement? And in what way was securing that commitment from Putin any kind of a breakthrough, when even while European leaders were meeting Donald Trump at the White House yesterday, the Russians were putting out a statement saying, no, we didn't agree to anything like that. Absolutely not. I think they actually accused Keir Starmer of feeding that line to Donald Trump, as though the British government in some way was responsible for the words that came out of Witkoff's mouth on CNN on Sunday. I meant to mention this the other day, by the way. Forgot. Steve Witkoff, who, as you know, is this real estate magnate and golfing buddy of Donald Trump, he agrees he's got no foreign policy experience as he flies around the world meeting with Putin and Netanyahu and all of these kind of people. But he has disclosed that one of the ways that he has boned up on foreign policy is by watching a whole raft of Netflix documentaries about history. So that's good.
You mentioned that
I know
he,
what I'm going to do tonight.
Yeah. You mentioned that he said that Ukraine... No, you didn't mention it. He said it on the clip that you played. Ukraine is going to get a lot of land. Does that What does that mean? That they're going keep some land or get some extra land?
Absolutely no idea. He keeps talking about land swaps. Well, I can understand what he wants Ukraine to give up. The Crimea, the entire region of Donbass. Who knows? Maybe even more. But he keeps saying that Ukraine's going to get a lot of land. I actually think what he meant by that today was that at the end of the day, Ukraine's still going to have loads of land. I don't think he was suggesting in that particular interview, as he has suggested in other appearances, that Russia in some way is going to give up land. I mean, what land would Russia give up to Ukraine as part of this? There's absolutely no indication that that's taking place. There was another brief clip from the interview that's worth a listen, where, again, he kind of makes the history of Ukraine up to fit his own narrative. Take a listen to this.
Ukraine was sort of a buffer between Russia and the rest of Europe. And it was a big, wide buffer. Everything worked out well until Biden got involved.
It was a big, wide buffer until Biden got involved. I mean, what does that mean?
Do you think that he actually believes the things that come out of his mouth? That by simply saying them, they become true. Is he a person that has never been corrected, and that is increasingly true, and so it's just in a sort of a fantasy that he creates for himself?
Well, he definitely didn't like it when he was corrected yesterday by Friedrich Merz. There's no question that that the German Chancellor got under his skin yesterday in the conversation about ceasefires, because the German Chancellor says there's got to be a ceasefire before you can have full peace negotiations, and Donald Trump waves that away and says it's not necessary, as though it's a minor issue, which it clearly is not. I think on a whole raft of policies now, this is not just about Ukraine. This is about his governing principle. Whether he at first believes the stuff he's saying, I don't know. But eventually he comes to believe it all. I think he genuinely now believes that there is a crime wave in Washington, D.C. that has turned this city into bedlam, that it's not safe for any of us to go out. And now, a week after he ordered the National Guard completely unnecessarily to take up positions in this city, he is claiming that friends of his are calling him up. He said this yesterday. He'd had two friends of his that had called him up and said, I've just gone out to a restaurant in Washington for the first time in 4 years. Thank you so much for making it safe for me and my family to go out.
Yeah.
We've had Kristi Noem, the head of the Homeland Security Department, today saying residents of Washington are finally able to go to the grocery store again. I mean, it's absolute fiction. I can also tell you from another piece of my life, one of the outfits that I report from, four from here, is in South Africa. And if you look at what he's done to the U.S. bilateral relationship with South Africa, based on an entirely false narrative, he claims completely falsely that the South African government is expropriating land from Afrikaner farmers, actively doing it. This is something that has never happened. There is a new law in place that theoretically one day might perhaps allow the government to do it, but they've never done it. He's convinced himself that it's actively happening, and as a result of that, he has thrown the nation's doors open to white Afrikaners who want to claim refugee status in the United States. He's closed the country's doors to everybody else but white Afrikaner farmers who can take advantage of the complete misinformation that he is spreading about what is taking place in South Africa, can appeal to be granted refugee status and are being welcomed to the United States as refugees. So in all of these different pockets, it's policy being completely based on misinformation. The South African government cannot get him back on the straight and narrow. And I think with regard to Ukraine, European governments are going to struggle to do that as well.
You know, you talked about his governing principle. I think that was summed up perfectly in the photograph of the of the leaders exiting through the gift shop of the White House while Trump showed off his Trump 2028 merchandise.
So this is a new thing. This is a new thing. He started doing it. It started with the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan last week when they were here to sign a peace agreement at the White House. And credit to him for making that happen. You know, it's one of the most intractable conflicts in the world. And if he's able to deliver some measure of peace to it, then that's an achievement. They were escorted to the gift shop by the president with members of their delegation. And he shows them the Trump 2028 hat. He, you know, very generously says to everybody there, help yourself, take whatever you want, take it, you know, take it all. Yesterday, he took Zelensky, I think, I can't remember who else was in there. Was it Merz or Stubb, I think, from Finland, and maybe one other. They got taken into the White House gift shop. And when he had the European leaders in the Oval Office, if you look at the picture of them sitting there all looking somewhat devastated by the day that they've gone through with him as he holds court in the Oval Office on the Resolute desk, you can see that he's got these gold keys to the White House that he gives everybody when they come visiting in wooden boxes. And you sit there and you think, you know, Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron, Giorgia Meloni, who always looks like she just can't wait to get out of his orbit, even though he seems to like to flirt with her and thinks that, you know, she she's on his side.
Yeah.
They're all just sitting there thinking, I just want to go home. And now we've got to go. And now he's going to give me the golden key. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Well, give is would yeah. be a surprise. If they paid for it, I wouldn't be remotely surprised. No refunds, no exchanges. Simon, yeah, exactly. Always a pleasure. Thanks for that. Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent. LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
The government is, we're told, paving the way for the state pension age to be raised to 70 as a review considers tying future increases to life expectancy. Torsten Bell is the pensions minister and Labour MP for Swansea West. Do you ever see a time when the state pension is means tested?
Well, absolutely not. That's a mad idea. The only person that suggested that is Kemi Badenoch. It's a lunacy. I'm sure you're putting into a private pension.
I am, and you're coming for it.
Wait, I'm not coming for it. That's a ridiculous thing.
You're going to put my private pension. Pension, whatever's left of it, maybe in the future. Well, if I want to give that to my children, you're going to put that in, roll that into inheritance.
Absolute madness.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player, and the new LBC app.
There now follows a message from the Prime Minister.
Some of you may know my husband is being held hostage. They are targeting me. They have weaponized my family. I will not be threatened. My loyalties are to this country. I will not allow it to be held to ransom. And anyone who thinks that I would has badly underestimated me.
Hostage, starring Saran Jones, coming soon only on Netflix.
The ASA regulates UK ads across all media, including radio, to make sure they stick to the rules. You should be able to trust the ads you hear, whether you love them or hate them. So we're by your side and keeping our ears open because every little helps. The ASA, keeping ads legal, decent, honest and truthful. Oh, yes.
Daniel liked how easy it was to transfer his old pensions to PensionBee.
I've had quite an eclectic career, and with that, I'd amassed pensions from a couple of different providers. I signed up using the app. It was really straightforward. I was able to give them a couple of key facts about each of my pensions, and then PensionBee did the rest of the work for me.
At PensionBee, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to PensionBee.com. And be pension confident. When investing, your capital is at risk.
Train to Bedford with the crew for a music festival. Scenes.
Georgie, is this too much glitter?
Yep, lost them. Bored off to get drinks on my own. It's okay, find the flag with the DJ and cat. Ah, there they are.
Rich!
Back on the train, glitter gone, feet destroyed. Totally worth it. Oh, I can't wait to post this selfie of us. Download the Thameslink Railway app to book tickets and save one third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
So back to our conversation about the government and Starmer's performance so far, which seems to have resulted in him being quite the unpopular leader. Tower Hamlets. Hello, James.
Oh, hello. Good evening, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Right. A couple of things. Let's talk about Palestine action, first of all. Now, I would agree that none of us know what the intelligence picture was that was shown to the Home Secretary. But what I can tell you is that no Home Secretary takes these decisions lightly. There must have been compelling evidence of such serious nature that she's felt constrained that she had to prescribe this organisation.
Right, well, we'll just have to trust her on it.
Well, I think that's what we're going to have to do. Now, in terms of people who've been arrested for showing outwardly supporting what is now a banned organisation, two words come to mind, cannon fodder. Cannon fodder for those people who are behind Palestine Action and the people who are behind them. Now, we don't know whether these people are of malign intent, okay?
Which people?
Whoever is behind Palestine Action.
Right.
Okay? Not the front people, the people behind them. There's always people behind people, okay, who are pulling strings.
Right, but you don't think that the people that were arrested were actually standing up for whoever these shadowy individuals are that you're referring to?
I think the people who were arrested were naive, okay? I think their intentions are fine to bring publicity on what's happening in Gaza. Now, I don't condone the Israeli government.
That's not naive, though, is it?
However, the government took the decision to proscribe this organization. The law is absolutely clear. Now, we can say that the law is wrong, the law is an arse, as some people say, but the law is absolutely clear. If you show support for banned terrorist organizations, outward signs of support, you will get yourself arrested.
Yeah, I know. But it seems bizarre that the police would stand in front of a man holding a kill 'em all sign outside an asylum seeker's hotel and do nothing at all, and somebody holding up a joke from a private eye would be harassed by the law.
Well, obviously, it'll be down to the CPS to decide whether that person is going to... whether that person meets the threshold for a charge under the Terrorism Act. Okay, that's down to the CPS to decide. The police only do when the police have to interpret the law. Okay.
Yeah. Well, and is it your opinion that they're actually doing a good job in that regard?
I actually used to be a Metropolitan Police officer. I'm now retired, and I thought the police were under, you know, great stress.
Yes or no?
I think they've done a very good job.
Okay. All right. Good to hear from you, James. Thanks for that. Going to switch it up after the news. Coming up, parents are skipping meals in order to pay for their children's school uniforms, with costs spiralling to such an extent that parents are being pushed into debt, relying on Klarna-style payments. Do you remember school uniforms being this expensive? And is it time for us to scrap uniforms altogether? Do they actually have an effect on behaviour and performance? I'll be speaking with a state school campaigner to discuss all that. And I'll get your thoughts too on 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the High Court has ruled a council in Essex no longer has to house asylum seekers at a local hotel. Epping Forest District Council argued public safety was being put at risk because of ongoing protests outside the Bell. The council's thanked the judge for listening to the concerns of local people. But Steve Smith from Care for Calais told LBC he fears there could be multiple copycat cases.
It comes back to that question, where next? Where do you put all of those people in the 210, I think it is at the moment, 210 hotels? Where do you put them all? I mean, there is an answer, and that is obviously to speed up processing and get rid of the horrendous backlog that exists at the moment. But that's got to be done very carefully and in a considered and professional manner.
Well, the government says it will carefully consider the judgment. Donald Trump has ruled out sending US troops to Ukraine as part of security guarantees in the event of a peace deal. Last night, the president revealed America would be involved in preventing future Russian aggression. He was hosting the Ukrainian president and a number of European leaders at the White House. Luke Harding, The Guardian's foreign correspondent, told LBC it's been a tumultuous day for the president.
He meets Volodymyr Zelensky in the White House yesterday and Keir Starmer and other European leaders, and it seems he's kind of inching back towards Ukraine, and now we have him flip-flopping again. And despite the colour, the spectacle, the theatre, the unprecedented sight of all these leaders gathering together and sitting around the table with Trump, I'm not sure anything has fundamentally changed. I mean, it seems to me that Russia's plan to conquer Ukraine continues, and of course the Russians continue to bomb.
A 32-year-old man's admitted killing a young woman while driving 140 miles per hour on Christmas Day in 2022. Evan Ford's Mercedes crashed into the back of a BMW in Brent Cross in North London. Maria Carolina Dos Cimento was a passenger and died at the scene. The Treasury won't confirm reports it's considering plans to replace stamp duty for buyers. Instead, sellers would have to pay the levy on properties worth more than £500,000. And millions of households have been warned to brace themselves for higher winter energy bills. Industry experts are predicting a £17 a year increase in Ofgem's price cap. LBC weather, a cloudy start for many tomorrow, becoming sunnier in the afternoon, especially in the southwest and northwest, a high of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Parents in England are apparently skipping meals and turning to buy now, pay later services such as Klarna in order to afford school uniforms before the start of the autumn term, according to a new survey. Let's speak about this with Michael Pike. Michael is a spokesperson for the Campaign for State Education and is also a former teacher. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening, Nick.
This seems like an extraordinary state of affairs. How much does it cost to kit a child out in regulation school uniform?
That's a long time since my children were at school. I believe it can come to as much as a couple of £100 by the time you've got everything.
And presumably, as they're growing, they're going to need a new set every year.
Well, certainly, regularly, yes. It's not something that... I'm still wearing clothes I bought years ago. No, it's very true. They're growing, and it's not great value.
Yeah, and presumably there's no impetus for providers to give good value because they'll be sole providers, am I right?
Well, I think what seems to have happened is that schools are increasingly, presumably because they think in some sort of way it confers status, have gone for uniforms which have a large element of branding in them. Which, as you say, results in the supplier having a monopoly, and this inevitably means higher prices.
Yeah, and when you say branding, what is it you're talking about?
Well, for example, a school will appoint a sole supplier who then produces uniforms which include a stitched-in badge or piping on the blazer or whatever.
Right. Now, piping is a bit difficult, but I recall from my school days that we used to buy an unbranded generic uniform, and then we sewed the badge on ourselves. Is that not possible anymore?
I think it probably is. There's supposed to be a legal limit on the number of branded items in this sense that a school can insist on. But it seems to be at least four or five.
Were they wearing uniforms when you were a teacher in your school, kids?
Yes. Our school did have a uniform. We certainly didn't have appointed suppliers. It's not that simple. I mean, we seem to be stuck with school uniform. It seems to be part of our culture, and there are other countries in the world which have school uniform. Japan's an obvious example. Most European countries don't. And the arguments for having it or not having it are obviously very well known. My view from my experience is that you don't solve this problem by simply encouraging parents to buy cheap clothes. Because, unfortunately, in no time at all, they look cheap.
Yes, and they'll probably wear out more quickly than something
else. They wear out more quickly, and one of the arguments that's frequently put forward in favour of school uniform is it's supposed to eliminate obvious social class differences. Well, obviously, it doesn't if some children are wearing much better quality uniform than others. When I taught in Wolverhampton, when I first started teaching Wolverhampton back in the 1980s, there was a school uniform grant available.
Right. Well, that seems to be the case in a lot of education, that things used to be considerably cheaper and grants were available, and education, you know, particularly at university, I'm thinking, was free. And you got a bursary on top.
Yeah, well, I can understand why university's not free anymore. I mean, in the days it was free, only 6% of the population went there. And now it's more like 49%.
Yes.
So... the economics of it just don't stack up. But with schools, the reason there aren't uniform grants anymore is that local authorities have no money. And that's because of 14, 15 years of deliberate government policy.
Yes. You know, some people say that a uniform encourages good behaviour and improves performance. Is that your experience?
No. I mean, I don't honestly think there's any relationship between wearing school uniform and measurable outcomes. The only arguments in favour of school uniform are it makes it easier to recognise who is a member of your school and who isn't. And in theory, it does away with issues about what to wear every day. There is some evidence in favour of that. I remember at our school in Wolverhampton, two American girls came for a year on a cross-cultural visit, and they were astonished at having to wear uniform. But after a while, they actually admitted that they preferred it to being in their American high school, where there was constant competition among the girls for to wear the best clothes and stuff. So I think you would have to have some kind of dress code, even if you don't have a uniform. But as things are, it's not very good at all.
Yeah, and that identifier you were talking about, is it possible that that actually prevents bad behaviour outside school? Because by wearing a school badge, then people would know at least which organisation to complain to.
I don't think anyone's ever done any research into this, but it may inhibit children. On the other hand, it does also tend to encourage insularity between schools. Most educational theorists think that education systems work better when schools cooperate and work together. Uniforms, of course, like football kits, they encourage loyalty to the institution and rivalry with the others.
Tribalism.
Yes, they do. They do. That's well put. Yeah.
You mentioned that there are that schools express a certain provider, or they insist on a certain provider.
Yeah.
Do schools get a cut, a sort of kickback from those providers that they've given
not,
this?
Not normally.
Really?
Not normally. No. I think a lot of that has to do with the desire to assert status. And when I went to grammar school in the 1950s, there were just two nominated suppliers of our school uniform in Preston, where I lived. You had to buy from one or the other. I did notice, working in the West Midlands, we shared a campus with a very well, very desirable Church of England school. Well, it was at the time very desirable. And when they... It seemed to matter to the parents that the uniform was one that was obtained from shops that were thought to be a cut above the norm. But as I say, there were uniform grants available at the time, so that probably mitigated the issues for the poorer children.
And when you and I were at school, the kind of kit that we used to have to bring along would amount to pens, pencils, a rubber, a slide rule.
Protractor. Yeah, certainly not a tablet or a laptop. No.
Right. Yes. So, do parents get any help with that? Because
no, they don't. Right. No.
And yet, schools can insist on it.
Yes, they can. I think it's what we're really seeing, of course, is more of a socioeconomic problem than an educational problem, because inequality has grown, and these problems are surfacing more and more and more, but it's not something schools can easily solve. I mean, it is tricky. I mean, at my school, we had, the one I last taught in, we had a second-hand uniform shop. And you won't be surprised to learn that the only children who ever bought from the second-hand uniform shop were the better-off children.
Were they? I am surprised to learn that.
No, if you think about it, the poor children wouldn't buy from the second-hand uniform shop because they didn't want people to think that they couldn't afford a new uniform.
Right.
Whereas the children from the better-off homes knew perfectly well that they could afford a brand new uniform. It was just a sensible choice they were making.
Like aristocrats wander around with their elbows poking out of their jackets because they're just wearing the same thing for 50 years.
Exactly so.
Go on. No, you please.
I was going to say, it is a tricky business. The way children feel about themselves relates enormously to how they see their families standing in society. And if children are poor and deprived, the last thing they want is a second-hand uniform.
So it does seem a bit much to expect parents not only to shell out many hundreds of pounds a year for the uniform, but also have to come up with all this tech and the gadgets and all that stuff on top without any assistance to do that. So this new law that they're bringing in, under this new legislation, parents will be able to buy cheaper uniform staples like shirts and trousers from general retailers. But is that actually going to make much difference, considering how much extra they have to pay for everything else?
Well, it'll make a small difference. I mean, it's well-meaning, but then, of course, it creates the same sort of problem as the old free school meals conundrum, that the children who have the cheap uniforms will feel stigmatised.
So how do you think the government can, other than just throwing money at it, what can be done for this?
This is a very big problem for us, really. I mean, the government's short of money, obviously, these problems have arisen because of the sort of economic policies governments have pursued for the last 20, 25 years. Increasingly, we have a growing gap between the better off and the worse off in society. The welfare state answer to it that we had up to the 1990s or so, was, of course, to try and even things out by having grants and that sort of thing through the local authority. But since we've now had a government which has starved local authorities for 15 years of necessary cash, local authorities can't even do that. If I had my way, we wouldn't have school uniform, but I don't think that I'm spitting in the wind. Parents seem to think it's a really good idea.
And yet, in your experience, it doesn't actually change behaviour or outcomes.
No. It's to do with the history of our country. School uniforms came from the private schools, which absolutely mushroomed in the 19th century. Everything that happened in the state schools was an attempt to imitate the private schools. I remember at school we had houses.
Yeah.
We didn't live in them.
Right.
They were just artificial organisations that competed for house points. This was just copying the public schools. It was to try and gain status. Uniforms, very much the same sort of idea. We do what our betters do. And it's very hard to persuade people otherwise. There was a school in Walsall which had a very enlightened head, and he abandoned school uniform, and in no time at all, he started losing numbers.
Why? Because the parents didn't think that they thought
the
that
the parents thought it wasn't a proper school,
right?
And they didn't have a uniform.
That the education would be somehow lacking because of the absence of the uniform.
Exactly. They associated uniform with the necessary status. It's a cultural thing which would be extremely difficult to counteract. I think the only answer is for the government to bite the bullet and find some money for this sort of thing.
Well, it's being that's a request that's coming from north, south, east and west, and they're
I do believe they are looking at ways of refinancing local authorities. I think they seriously are. After 25 years of doing nothing about it, they are actually looking at things like the council tax, which of course is hugely out of date. They are looking at finding ways of local authorities being able to get better financing. Without that, I think it's. I mean, unless we're going to have wholesale redistribution of wealth in society, which I don't see happening very quickly.
So I suppose it's not much, but at least it's a little that this new legislation, parents will be able to buy cheaper uniform staples.
Yes.
And that comes in September, after which, presumably, they will have, parents will have bought their uniform for this year. So not for this year, perhaps, but for next year, it might make a difference.
Yes, I mean, I think the government's very well-meaning on the subject. Its problem is it's inherited an economic mess. Mm. It's struggling to get out of it.
Yeah, which underscores much of their travails. Exactly right. Thank you, Michael. Michael Pike, spokesperson for the Campaign for State Education, also a former teacher. That does seem extraordinary, though, doesn't it? Parents in England are skipping meals to buy the uniform for their children. Does it really cost that much? Do schools actually insist on too many things that need to be bought, branded already? And it doesn't really encourage prices to be pushed down if the schools only anoint one company with the ability to actually provide this kit in the first place. That's not capitalism, is it? 0345 6060 973. Do you think that maybe the era of the school uniform has come and gone? Should we ditch it? Or, unlike what Michael was saying there, do you think that maybe it does sort of instill a certain type of behaviour in a child? Does it make them sort of metaphorically and literally sit up straight and pay attention? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
LBC.
Would anyone like some Bourneville dark chocolate?
Is it so dark the aftertaste lasts for a week?
No.
Does it taste really, really complicated?
What?
Is it saturated in nibs?
So dark it comes with a therapist.
To the uneducated palate, does it taste like burnt tyre?
Would scientists compare the taste to dark matter?
Is it artisanal, in all caps?
Are the tasting notes gloom?
No, no pretentiousness, no complexity, no bitterness. Just smooth dark chocolate from Cadbury. Cadbury Bourneville, made to be enjoyed, not endured.
Have you ever wondered what becoming a lotto millionaire sounds like?
You want to sit down? I can confirm that you have won £1 million indeed.
That's Terry finding out he'd won £1 million.
Yes. Oh my God.
Lotto from the National Lottery. Will you be the next millionaire? Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet. Ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Ta. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you. Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah. It's Business Ready Broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
Yeah, we're talking about the eye-watering cost of sending a child to school, because not only have you got to buy the bag and the shoes and the PE kit and the laptop and the pens and propelling pencils or whatever the hell it is that they take to school these days, but you've also got to kit them out with branded merchandise. And the brand is, of course, the school badge, which, and I said this before, is something that we used to, well, I didn't, but Mum did, sew it on ourselves. You bought some generic uniform and then sewed on the badge at home. Is it that we just don't have the ability to sew anymore, or is that sort of not... is not an option that is being made available? 0345 6060 973. Brent in Derby. Hello.
Good evening, Nick. How are you? I'm going to come at this a couple of ways. I'll have a child who will say, I can't afford a pen, sir, but in their pocket is a £600 phone.
Mm.
And I think there's, if I go into the lost and found in our school, I will see £100 trainers, jackets, all sorts of stuff, and think, what are the kids doing? There's a generation of kids out there who are very entitled. I mean, God bless their parents. They just keep replacing stuff, and they just keep losing stuff. And if you go into any school, go into a lost and found cupboard, you'd be shocked with the amount of money that is just thrown away. So So that's one thing where there are parents sacrificing for their children. I'm going to be honest with you, their children don't deserve how hard their parents are working sometimes to keep up with the Joneses.
Well, just so on that subject, just as we know, is the school that you are teaching in a well-off area?
I have quite a mix. So it, being a faith-based school, I would get children from economic deprived, deindustrialised Midlands area, and also children who are from affluent backgrounds.
Okay.
And the thing about the uniform, which is interesting, is the uniform is a good leveller from that point of view of it is hard to tell who's who. And the thing about a uniform, which is important, is about standards. For me, uniform is important about, I fight on uniform, I fight on appearance, so I don't have to fight on other areas. And that's about upholding the standards, about respect, about tradition. And uniform is important. Now, what has happened to some schools is they've been taken over by multi-academy trusts, corporations, so to speak. And they have branded everything in a new logo, a new colour, a new this, almost like football teams. And they've gone way too far. Because they've come in and they said, new head teacher comes in, and they come in with a new sort of like, well, turn this school around. And the first thing they do, Nick, is go straight for the uniform, redesign the uniform, new badge, new logo, new school, and they go zero tolerance. And they literally become almost uniform Nazis. And your local newspapers up and down the country are littered with, in September, a child who was sent home because they had the wrong colour of socks on or something.
Right.
And it has gone too far with some schools because they think the best way to get discipline is to literally enforce these rules, almost draconian, and that's too far the other way. But a uniform is important for most schools because it sets a standard and it levels the playing field, and it is important because kids need direction. They need some sort of boundaries. If you turn around, my worst day of the year teaching is non-uniform day because everything just goes to pot. Because the kids are just right, I can wear what I want, I can do what I want, and that is... We saw it during COVID, saying to kids, you can do what you want, when you want, how you want. Good luck, Lord of the Flies.
But does that actually follow, that they can wear what they want so they feel they can do what they want?
It's very much getting that way, Nick. Again, getting a sense of routine. And you take neurodivergent children or children with complex needs. The thing they need the most is consistency, consistency and consistency. They need routines, they need set rules, set standards. And when you're dealing with a large group of people, keeping it simple is the best way forward. Making it more complicated is tricky. And that's why a uniform is a good thing for, right, here's your uniform, here's what we expect of you. And it does work if you can create the culture. So you don't just go in with uniform, you try and create a culture where the parents are on board. And I think for some schools are getting it wrong is they're really getting parents back up when they have branded shorts and branded this and branded that. They've gone too far. However, there's other schools where the parents are saying, oh, it's ridiculous. What connection is it to uniform and the child? It is. There is a connection. I can tell you as a teacher of 23 years, there's a massive connection to uniform. It's flipped this. How would parents feel if I walked in wearing a pair of Bermuda shorts and just wearing what I want as a teacher? What would you think? What would you think of me as a teacher if I didn't look like a teacher, talk like a teacher, walk like a teacher? What do you think? I'm taking that guy seriously. So no, I'm standing in front of the kids suited and booted because I well expect them to stand in front of me and show me the same respect and be wearing what I think is appropriate for me to teach them. Wouldn't have a doctor walking around in a pair of flip-flops, would you?
But you say it's a leveller, but it's only a leveller if everyone can afford it.
True, and that's where I think the government is on to something about making uniforms more affordable by debranding them. And especially when I talk about uniform, I'm talking about the whole shebang. The PE kit is included in that as well, because the number of items, what they're trying to say is the number of items you can brand has to be reduced. And I think that's positive. I think that's a good idea. Because black pair of trousers in your local supermarket, all right, three or four pair of those, you go through them in a year. But that's about £20 as opposed to these branded pair of trousers. And you can get decent clothes these days from supermarkets that can last. The problem is when the kids are out playing football and kicking holes in them and everything else, it's down to how the children use those use their uniform or lose their uniform, as I'm saying, and how they look after their clothes. And that's the same with a pen. If I lend a child a pen, I will take their mobile phone from them and say, right, you give me that pen back tomorrow, I'll give you a mobile phone. Guess what I'd get back? I'd get that pen back if I took their mobile phone from them.
You took a mobile phone off a child and lived to tell the tale.
Oh, man, you don't believe it. We actually do that. If the children have no tie in the morning, we take their mobile phone from them and say, right, you're in perpetuity, we're taking your mobile phone. But guess what we get back? We get that tie back because they value that mobile phone. If they wanted to look after their... And I think it's a generational thing where we look after things. I lost my equipment when I was a school. I've gone back to my dad and said to my dad, I've lost my £15 calculator back in the 1990s. You've got no chance. I'm dead. Now it's like, it's the teacher's fault. It's their fault. Kids, and this is like, what they expect, we'll give them everything. They just get everything given to them and expect it to be given to them.
It's very much a throw. We're living in very much in a throwaway society. Nothing gets fixed anymore. If it's, you know, got a chip in it or, it requires some sort of mending, then we don't do that, do we? Just chuck it away and get another one. And that's probably been that sort of mindset, if what you say is right, has been passed on to the children.
But I do agree, uniform is an important part of an identity of a school. It's important part of a culture. But it is part of something else. You've got uniform, you've got behaviour, you've got expectations. And that's what it comes down to me. It's about standards and expectations. I expect the children to be properly dressed in front of me. And equally, parents should expect that I'm going to do a damn good job as their teacher of their child. Because that's their expectations of me. But that's my expectations of them, that they send their children to school properly dressed. And I'm speaking from working class because my parents had pride. Even though my parents struggled to put food on the table, I was still sent to school with a uniform on because my parents wouldn't have it said that I was sent inappropriately dressed. So when people are turning around and saying about, well, you know, I can't afford this, I can't afford that, well, maybe the £600 mobile phone in their back pocket is less important than the pair of shoes that they're wearing on their feet. And it's about priorities. And I think education has been deprioritized. So when people are saying about, oh, I begrudge. It's the same as the holiday issues. People can afford to go on holidays and say, but, oh, yes, you know, I'll take the fine on the holiday when I can have an extra couple of days at Disneyland. Ha ha, it's funny. It's the way they're talking about education now is if it's everybody else's fault. Take some responsibility. Children go to school, and some of the best-dressed kids, your expert is right, coming to school are the children from poorer backgrounds because they do have a sense of pride and they do have a sense of, you know what, I'm sending my children going exactly how they should look to go to school because I've got pride in what my children look like. I think that's important because if their pride in her children's appearance, their pride in their achievements, they're proud of who they are, I think it's about standards and it's about respect. And I think that's something that we're starting to lose in this country.
Very good to talk to you, Brent. Thanks for that. What do you reckon on school uniforms? I mean, they do cost a heck of a lot of money. And, of course, they're very specific that you can only wear them when you're going to school. So you've got this part of your wardrobe that is off limits on any other part of the week. So it is an expense that you wouldn't have made otherwise. And if people are, as this survey suggests, actually skipping meals, if adults are skipping meals just so that they can afford some branded merchandise, essentially is what it is, isn't it, for the school that they send their children to, then there's clearly something out of whack there. It's either the kit is too expensive or they're being required to buy too much of it. And do you believe that school uniform actually does affect behaviour and by extension, performance? Do you get better exam results if you have a what is essentially, I mean, let's face it, school uniform is, you know, it's not Savile Row, is it? It's a cheap, probably nylon get-up that kids will attempt to wear badly. I mean, they take the uniform and they twist it in some way so as to go right up to the line of the rule, but not actually cross it. Which sort of ruins the idea of a uniform at all because they're not wearing it in the way that it is that it was intended. But I mean, I guess that's just kids for you. But do you think it makes a difference? 0345 6060 973. It's just past 11:30 on LBC. The news headlines with Daryl Jackson.
The government says it will carefully consider a judgment granting an interim injunction to block asylum seekers from being housed in a local hotel. Epping Forest District Council had applied to the High Court following a series of protests outside the Bell. Donald Trump's promised US troops won't be sent to support security guarantees in Ukraine, but the US president has suggested American jets could be used to support efforts to avoid any future Russian aggression. And Egyptian and Qatari mediators are still waiting for a formal response from Israel to a ceasefire deal approved by Hamas. It would see the group release some Israeli hostages in return for a 60-day truce. LBC weather, a cloudy start for many tomorrow, becoming sunnier in the afternoon, especially in the southwest and northwest, a high of 24 degrees.
This is LBC.
train to Peckham. Kids in tow, rooftop cinema time.
6 packs of popcorn? I think one will do, Nina.
Ah, clear skies, comfy seats, a talking panda. Clearly what we all needed. Okay, everyone's seated now, happily doing panda impressions. I wonder when Nan can watch the kids so I can come back with James. Oh, just the two of us.
Download the Southern Railway app to book advanced tickets from only £8 on off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
Bring your pensions together into one easy-to-manage online plan with PensionBee. Because when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. When investing, your capital is at risk.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
If I need an eye test, I don't go to Specsavers.
One thing you won't see at Specsavers is me.
Do I go?
Yeah!
I mean, no.
Me? I don't go to Specsavers. Nor you, eh, Spike?
Should have gone to Specsavers. Nah.
Hi, Specsavers. Here for your eye test.
They come to me instead.
Come in. Kettle's on.
Oh, thank you.
If you can't go to Specsavers unaccompanied, we could come to you. See if you're eligible at specsavers.co.uk/home visits.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Do you think the age of the school uniform is over? I've asked a couple of teachers so far in this hour, and they seem to be certain that it does affect behaviour. But not every school has a school uniform. And not every country insists on such a thing. So we're something of an anomaly. So if it doesn't affect the behaviour of children in other countries who, you know, would perhaps get better school results than we do, then why should it affect behaviour in this country? 0345 6060 973. And have you found it difficult to actually come up with the kind of money that they're asking for here? £400, it's been suggested that it costs to kit out a kid with 10 items. That would be including the PE kit. £400. And of course, that's not that won't last very long because they're growing. So you probably have to buy an entire set every year. Colour codes. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Nick. I think school uniforms, I just think school uniforms give somebody some kind of identity to the school. And I think youngsters look smart in uniforms instead of just wearing casual clothes. So
do they, though?
You know, I'm absolutely... Sorry?
Do they, though? I mean, when I was a kid at school, everybody at my school would take the uniform and do something to it. They would hoik the trousers up so you could see their luminous green socks, or they'd have their tie askew or tied in a knot so fat that it virtually covered the entire of their front, or they'd festoon themselves with badges under the lapel so the teachers couldn't see them, but you knew that they were there. They'd do something in order to take the rules and break them just enough to make some sort of, you know, statement of individuality, thereby making the uniform not look, A, like a uniform, and B, not smart.
Oh, well, I've got four daughters, Nick, all different ages, and they all went to the same school, and they were absolutely strict, you know, on presentation. If you had a shirt button undone, you'd get... You'd get detention, or, you know, they do check all, well, at my daughter's school, they check the kids and make sure they look tidy, you know, presentable, shoes clean, polished, everything. Do you know what I mean? The tie straight, if it anything out of place, you got detention. And
isn't that a bit much, though?
I think it's good because it gives, you know, when they leave school in the future and they get, because I'd like to say four daughters all at the same school, you know, we've just basically kept part of the uniform handed down to the younger
right.
Like daughter when she went to the school, but they did actually get rid of the blazer in place of a, you know, school jumper, shirt, tie, obviously for the girls a dress or you know, a skirt and stuff. I mean, like, you know, the tie as well. They had the emblem on the tie, but they got rid of all the other logo stuff. So, I mean, as long as you bought a school tie, you could actually go to any, like, major supermarket to know for the white shirt or the, you know, the black skirt or whatever, you know. But basically, they were really strict on appearance. Do you know what I mean? They made sure everybody was, like, you know, following school regulations and stuff.
How did your youngest take it that everything she was wearing was a hand-me-down from her older sisters?
Not everything, actually. Obviously, shoes and that. You know, like, everybody got new shoes and stuff, and, like, tights and underwear and all kind of thing, but, like, shirts or pullover. I mean, the school did actually have a school shop, like somebody had mentioned before, like, you know, reconditioned items that you could hand into the school, and somebody else who was struggling could buy that item, you know, at a low price. You know, I sometimes had spare clothing for kids. You know, somebody came to school without a pullover on, they would have to go down to, you know, to the reception that, and they would get your one of the jumpers to put on, because they insisted on you, you know, wearing the jumper. Obviously, in the summertime, you could take the jumper off, but they were pretty strict on appearance and, you know, made sure everybody's hair was tidy and that, and, you know, everybody looked clean, and, you know, you got letters sent home if your child's shoes are scraped or whatever, you know, saying that the shoes are not up to standard and that.
It is a sort of anachronism, though, isn't it? Because there's precious few jobs left that would be that insistent on that level of detail and attention to following the norms. I mean, if you go work in a bank, I suppose, well, not even a bank these days, because the people behind the counter, they don't dress like that. So it's out of our current era, isn't it? It's not part of the modern world anymore. It's like a harking back to the 1970s.
Yeah, I just think school uniform gives you kind of identity. Like, you don't want kids going in with ripped jeans, some like sliced jeans, or, you know, Doc Martin boots on or whatever. You know, I just think it will just make the school look a bit like Raji. You know, so to me, I just think that uniforms makes youngsters look presentable, smart, you know, and I just think, to me, I think it's a good thing to have school uniforms, and I'd be a sad day they got rid of them all.
Okay, good to talk to you, Brian. Thanks for that. Had to kit 4 children out, which, if that £400, I mean, you know, not everything is, it would be new. Interesting that you said the boots and underwear, because that's the reason that Ian Dury called his first album New Boots and Panties, because those were the only items of clothing that he would buy new. Everything else was second hand. Manchester, hello, Raj.
Hi, Nick. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
It was just the underwear and the boots that got me on that one. That previous caller. Anyway, when I was younger, I mean, obviously I'm 50 years old now, but when I went to school, it was in the days where you went to the closest school, regardless of what was, whether it was good or not, it was because it was closest to you.
Yeah.
And you'd walk to school. But we only used to have colours. So you used to wear a certain type of coloured jumper, obviously black trousers and a white shirt. And we never even used to have a tie, actually, as it happens. But that's what it was in them days. And I remember, even as a kid now, where you'd be messing around in the playground and somebody would grab the sleeve of your arm, and you pull your jumper until it was about 16 feet long. So your sleeve was that long, and then you come home and you think, well, at least it only cost five or whatever it was in them days, and it wasn't as bad. But now, because I was just saying to your colleague beforehand, a couple of years ago, my daughter was in the last year of high school, it cost £800 for her uniform.
Why?
£800, can you believe it?
No, I can't. Why?
I've no idea. It's like £25 for a pair of white socks with a tiny little emblem on them.
Blimey. £25?
£25 for a white pair of socks. So like PE socks.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
It's absolutely ridiculous. And my son, he went to a different school only because that my daughter's school opened a couple of years afterwards. It was a new school. But him, when my son was at school, there's no way. Every time he went on every week, he'd lose something or he'd bring home something that wasn't his.
Right.
And literally, he'd come back with 4 socks or 3 socks or no socks. And it would just drive you nuts. And it's like if his head wasn't screwed on, he'd obviously leave that behind somewhere, which would have been all right, actually. But he that always came back. But this is the difference. I mean, in the end, I just turned around and said, look, just wear these white socks. I'm not even bothered about if they have a complaint about you, because it's just tough. I can't even buy new pairs of socks for you every other day.
Well, not at that price. No, I don't think I've ever bought socks at that price in my life.
I tell you about it. Even like Hugo Boss or, I don't know, whatever type of socks, I won't be paying that much for them, or whatever the most trendiest names are.
Was it a private school or state?
No, it was a normal school. No, state school. State school. But I was saying, when we were at my previous school, when I went to school, obviously I know it was a very long time ago, but there was the colours, and everybody used to wear the same colours, and there used to be standard stuff. It didn't even matter whether it was a V-neck shirt, a V-neck jumper, should I say, or a collared, like a round collar sort of jumper, as long as there was black, grey, or red. That was it.
I mean, I guess that is uniform, but it doesn't really sound like a uniform.
No, it doesn't. I mean, obviously you get kids wearing red, you know, blue, red jumpers, black jumpers, and grey jumpers, or whatever, but it just meant that at least everybody was sort of reasonably the same type of clothes.
Yeah, same age. Yeah,
the problem I always found was my son was the same. He'd come home, and literally one arm of his jumper would be stretched so long, it was untrue. And it just drives me nuts, as you can probably imagine. Now, it drives me nuts just thinking about it.
Yeah, that's kids for you. Good to talk to you, Raj. Thanks for that. This is interesting. This is from the Mirror a couple of years ago. You're not going to like it. School uniforms can harbour 12,000% more germs than a toilet seat. Tests found 5 to 6 year olds' school uniforms contain 12,353% more germs than the average toilet seat. School dresses had 1,700% more bacteria than a toilet hand dryer. Cardigans contain 900% more than a toilet's door handle. Supplements from Bimuno commissioned the study. Its in-house nutritionist said, the findings are concerning but not surprising. They're surprising me. School uniforms are often worn for multiple days without being washed, and they can be exposed to a variety of environments, including playgrounds, school buses and crowded classrooms. This creates a breeding ground for bacteria. God. School kids are lucky to be alive. 12,000% more germs than a toilet seat in a school uniform. Good grief. Well, with that in mind, is it a good idea to have kids wear the same clothes every day? Do you think that a uniform actually creates a certain type of behaviour? It sort of inculcates within children the sense that you know they're working, essentially, that they're there for a reason, rather than if they were just going in their normal kit, just to, they might feel more like mucking about. I don't know. Does it actually follow that a uniform makes children pay more attention, learn more, act differently? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
The government is, we're told, paving the way for the state pension age to be raised to 70 as a review considers tying future increases to life expectancy. Torsten Bell is the pensions minister and Labour MP for Swansea West. Do you ever see a time when the state pension is means tested?
Well, absolutely not. That's a mad idea. The only person that suggested that is Kemi Badenoch. It's a lunacy. I'm sure you're putting into a private pension.
I am, and you're coming for it.
Wait, I'm not coming for it. That's a ridiculous thing.
You're going to put my private pension, whatever's left of it, maybe in the future. Well, if I want to give that to my children, you're going to roll that into inheritance. Absolute madness.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player, and the new LBC app.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
When they're away at uni and the show you all love is on telly. When you're miles apart but still laughing at the same joke. When the emojis come thick and fast.
Ah, triple smiley face and a heart.
I knew they'd love that.
Nothing brings us together like great TV. Make sure your child has a TV license when they go to uni, so they're covered to watch all TV channels and you can still enjoy all those TV moments in the family group chat.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews.
Keep on smiling.
It's a chill summer's day. The twins are splashing in the paddling pool while Mrs. Thing puts her feet up. She's proper chuffed, having saved money on a British Gas boiler service. Now just £69, down from £109, with a free British Gas membership. Bliss. Well, it was nice while it lasted. British Gas, taking care of things. T's and C's apply. Applies to first year of annual boiler service only and renews at standard pricing. Membership required. Available to new boiler service contract customers. Ends 9th of September. Service by 30th of September.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yeah, we're talking about school uniforms, and the news that sort of brought this on was that parents, about half of the parents polled, said that they were worried about uniform costs, which can run into many hundreds of pounds because of the expensive branded items that schools insist on. And they found that people are forced into debt. They're using credit cards to pay for children's school uniform, credit card bills that they can't pay off in full, and you know what the interest rates are on those. And a third said that they rely on delayed payment services like Klarna just to kit their kids out with the school uniform that the that their schools insist on. 0345 6060 973. Vancouver. Hello, Nick.
Oh, hi, Nick. Yeah, I used to be a believer in school uniforms when I sort of, because I grew up with them. You know, I can remember giving some tailor on the Fulham Palace Road £5 to narrow my tie when the specials and, right. and the two-tone thing came out. Yes. Oh, I've got to have a narrow tie. but here in Canada, none of the high schools have uniforms routinely. There are some Catholics and some religious schools that, that have a uniform, but other than that, no. My foster kids and my daughter, they wear whatever they want when they go to school. And Canada routinely does better in academic rankings than the UK. You know, I don't think it makes any difference at all to either the behavior of the kids or how well they study in school. Yeah, it just makes no difference. I mean, if you want the kids to all look the same, then say, okay, you've all got to come in with a pair of, you know, like a pair of chinos and a golf shirt. You don't have to have a uniform to have them all look the same. You can say, look, you've all got to wear, you know, pair of khaki pants and a white golf shirt. That's it. That's the uniform. Buy them anywhere, you know, at whatever cost you want to spend.
I think even if you told them...
or Primark if you want.
Yes. I think even if you told kids nothing at all, they would all show up looking exactly the same, because that's what kids do.
Yes, yes. My kids all wear the same kind of baggy jeans these days and, you know, some kind of band T-shirt, goth-like, because that's the style here. You know, I mean, but yeah, it doesn't make any difference to their academic attainment. They, you know, it's a school. They're there to study. They're not there to stand in serried ranks and become little soldiers or what have. And as you said, particularly out here, no one wears any kind of uniform or work outfit here. Not at all.
Yeah, society is really
turned up in jeans and a T-shirt.
Yeah, right? Society has really gone in the other direction, hasn't it? And yet we're sort of insisting on this anachronism that that people, in order to work, must be suited and booted. They must have a tie and a dress shirt and you know, a proper blazer and dress trousers and shiny shoes and so on. That's that's from another era, and yet we're still insisting on it for children. And there's no doubt in my mind that it's less comfortable attire than if they could just, you know, show up in a tracksuit or something like that. And if you are working at home, you know, if you've got studying to do, whatever it might be, you wouldn't put a suit and a jacket on because it would detract or distract you from what it is that you're trying to do. You surely want clothes that you can forget you're wearing.
Yeah, I again, as I get older, I tend to sort of use school uniform as the traditional British thing of aping the upper class.
Yeah.
Well, if the kids at Eton have to wear a uniform, then my little Johnny has to wear one.
Right.
I mean, like I said, there's no appreciable advantage to you know, like, it's not like the kids of England are better behaved or better educated than the kids of America or Canada or anywhere else. Mm. Therefore, why are you asking parents to come up with £400 or £500 every year on something that statistically does absolutely nothing?
Right? Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just doesn't do anything statistically.
Right.
There's no evidence that it makes any difference to the kids at all.
All right, good to talk to you, Nick. Thanks for that. This is interesting. From last year, a study found that children who wear school uniform may be less physically active. Academics from Cambridge University say that uniforms might be a barrier to activity, with primary-aged girls particularly affected. The researcher who led the study said that schools should consider whether specific characteristics of a uniform restricted opportunities. They said that the new evidence would support decision-making about uniforms. Well, it hasn't at all, has it? We're still stuck with it. The team analysed data on the physical activity levels of more than 1 million youngsters aged 5 to 17 in 135 countries, including this one, and they found that school uniforms make kids less physically active. And I suppose that does make sense. You don't play football in a blazer. You play it in something more comfortable than that, and that must sort of inform children's, you know, the way they conduct themselves. You don't hair around in a jacket and tie like you would in a tracksuit. Leeds, hello, Tyler.
Hey, Nick. You like Pink Floyd, don't you?
Who doesn't?
Mm. The caller you had on, I really agree with the previous caller, by the way, from Canada. But you had a teacher on earlier, and he reminded me of that teacher leave the kids alone sort of thing. Like,
you.
Really disciplinarian.
Yes, you,
really
laddie.
Obsessed with it.
Yeah.
Yes, you cannot eat your pudding if you haven't got your meat. Yeah, you know, I think teachers take a very an overly zealous approach to this. I was in year 11 in 2016. We had to wear ties and blazers. Mm. We used to use the ties to whip each other or, like, strangle each other.
Yeah.
So I don't think that school uniform actually, you know, it gives you weapons in a sense.
Yeah, you see kids gathered around in clouds around bus stops, and it is quite comical what they do with ties. I mean, they seem to have fashioned ways of wearing them that had never been thought of before. Either the knot is as big as your fist, or there's a sort of reverse trump, and there's barely any tie visible beneath the knot at all. I don't know where the rest of it goes.
Well, the rest of it probably goes to money to actually pay for the. I'm a parish council, and I've canvassed a lot around Yorkshire. Some families that I've spoken to, they can barely afford to pay the rent, the food, and then they have to pay so much more on top of this. When I was in year 7 in 2011, we were a normal comprehensive. We didn't have to wear a blazer. We had a sort of a shirt and trousers and that, but then it got took over and essentially privatised by Delta Academy, and they had this big focus on, oh, we have to have an emblazoned blazer, and you have to have this, that and the other, and it massively shot up the costs, and they increase it every time.
Mm.
In my personal view, I think the only school uniform that you need, because, you know, some people like the idea of the tradition and all of that, I think that you should have no school uniform at all, apart from, like it were in the 50s, a flat cap, and it could be emblazoned with a white rose of Yorkshire or the Kent county flag, whatever that is. And because then that would show like a loyalty to get kids together with each other. But because you're doing it on scale then, on like a county basis, well, it'll cost less to actually produce the hats, which could be done at a better quality. Charge £10 for it. So that's the only uniform cost that families have. £10 for a flat cap, and the rest of it you can wear you want, because if kids are more comfortable and don't have, like, it was so warm some summers, and I remember blazers, we had this right nasty teacher, and he always ran about us, and you had to have it all buttoned up in your blazers and everything, even in the heat of boiling summer.
Mm.
It's ridiculous, the attitude that they have. And
well,
the material
that a school uniform is made from is not really a comfortable thing to wear, but it's mostly nylon, isn't it? I'm not sure about the flat cap thing. I think the very first thing that a kid would do with a flat cap is use it as a frisbee. But interesting idea. Thanks for that, Tyler. Reigate. Hello, Bradley.
Hi, Nick. Good evening. Thanks for having me. I think there's some really interesting theories behind everything here. I'm an advocate for using school uniform, but I think that one of the biggest issues that has been identified tonight is the fact of the cost towards the families. So I think that there needs to be some way in being able to make it more accessible. So, for example, there was a caller on a little bit earlier who spoke about getting rid of school blazers and having jumpers, or only having parts of the uniform. So, for example, having a tie for everybody. I think there could be ways that schools could look around. So then suddenly the cost isn't going to be £400, but maybe about £50, which could make it more manageable. Hmm. But the reason why I'm more of an advocate for wearing school uniform is I think the idea of school is to let any children, regardless of their background, an equal playing field for a shot at life, because the whole idea of school in the first place is to give your child the best opportunities to go forward. So if you've got a very diverse range of economic backgrounds going into a school, you could have some people wearing designer clothes and others going in, excuse me, wearing tracksuits, or maybe they've got a hole in their clothes, and that could make them potentially feel very self-conscious about their image, which could then cause further implications with their learning. Whereas if you have people who are all on the same page, just wearing simple black trousers, skirt, dress, shirt with a school tie, at least there's an equal playing field where there's one less thing to the child to have to worry about. I also think that there's another benefit of wearing uniform, and that is when callers identify the facts that teachers that are picking up with the fact that their ties aren't done up properly, or their buttons aren't done, or their shirt's untucked. All right, on the face of it, it is as it seems. But I think there's also further implications into that as well. And that is, if you're able to look after yourself, you're able to look at the minute details, that could be beneficial further on in life as well with your job. You know, whether that be going into medicine or into aviation or into finance or anything with life that you do, if you're able to have an eye out for the smaller things, that could also give a benefit for you as well. So I think there's more to it than just what's on the face of things.
Good to talk to you, Bradley. Thanks for that. Sorry I couldn't get through to all your calls. I'm going to have to give Bradley the last word on that. We're going to change it up after the news. The proportion of children saying that they have seen pornography online has risen in the past 2 years. That's according to a report which also found that children are likely to have stumbled upon pornography accidentally, or so they say. We'll be talking about that with our tech correspondent, Will Guyatt. The number 0345-6060-973. You can text 84850. Email nicka@lbc.co.uk. If you're on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone. 0345-6060-973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight, a council in Essex has been granted a temporary injunction blocking a local hotel from housing asylum seekers. The local authority had raised concerns about public safety following a series of protests in Epping. But lawyers for the Bell had warned the move would set a dangerous precedent. Chris Whitbread is the leader of Epping Forest District Council.
I took into account the strength of feeling of residents in Epping Forest. My local people have been contacting me directly and discussing this issue over the recent weeks, and I've been on the side of local people from day one. That's the most important thing.
President Trump's ruled out sending American troops to Ukraine as part of a peacekeeping agreement with Russia. In his first interview since talks in the White House with Volodymyr Zelensky, the president reined back on his ability to end the conflict. But his press secretary, Caroline Levitt, says if anyone can achieve peace, Donald Trump can.
President Trump is the only president this century, Republican or Democrat, who has held Russia in check and ensured peace in Europe. That's because Russia has always greatly respected President Trump and his peace through strength foreign policy approach.
There still hasn't been any official response from Israel after a fresh ceasefire deal for Gaza was proposed. It includes a 60-day pause in fighting and the return of 28 hostages and 200 Palestinian prisoners. Hamas has accepted the terms of the deal. A driver has admitted killing a young woman while speeding at 140 miles per hour in North London on Christmas Day in 2022. 32-year-old Evan Ford from Bedford crashed his Mercedes into the back of a BMW in Brent Cross. There are calls to shut down loopholes, which mean children are still able to access adult websites. England's Children's Commissioner's got concerns about them using VPNs, which can disguise an online location. Dame Rachel D'Souza says a new report found some concerning figures.
It's really bad. There are more children seeing porn at an earlier age, and the things they are seeing is having a great effect on them. About 50% of children see porn by the age of 13, 14.
And the government's reportedly looking at getting rid of stamp duty. The Chancellor could replace it with a tax on homes sold for more than £500,000 for the person selling the house. LBC weather, a cloudy start for many later this morning, becoming sunnier in the afternoon, especially in the southwest and northwest. Highs of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The proportion of children saying that they have seen pornography online has risen in the past 2 years. It's according to a report which also found that they are likely to have stumbled upon it accidentally. The Children's Commissioner, Dame Rachel D'Souza, said her research is evidence that harmful content is being presented to children through dangerous algorithms rather than them seeking it out. Let's talk about this with Will Guyot. Will is LBC's tech correspondent. Hello, Will.
Hello, Nick.
Well, pornography isn't like it used to be when schoolboys would pass around a tattered magazine they found in a railway siding back when there was no such thing as the internet. According to this report, it's somewhat different to that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite prevalent now. It's no longer stashed in the hedge as it was in my day. And that's the problem, because it's a lot easier to get this material and this content now. And perhaps one of the biggest issues, and why this whole thing with the Online Safety Act has been an absolute mess, because I don't think the government communicated the whole purpose of this thing particularly well, is that evidence seems to suggest that lots of young people stumbled across porn on the internet simply going to a place which either assumed they were 18 for some reason or another, or they clicked a tick box to say that they were 18, which meant that those sites then indiscriminately served porn to people. And then if you're using some of the social media platforms as well, some of them also make it quite easy to share pornographic content too. So you find yourself in a kind of a position here where it has got easier, kids are finding it by accident, but there's also sort of a number of sort of confusing points that have been conflated. And rather than protecting kids from porn, the whole thing about the Online Safety Act has turned into they're trying to stop us from looking at stuff we should all be able to look at.
Yeah, I mean, that word accidentally seems odd to me. How can you accidentally see pornography online?
You can stumble across it in a number of different places. So if you're looking to a website, or if you're looking to let's say you accidentally get to a page via a search or something, you click on a link and it takes you to a video on a social network, and the next video that follows that is an unsuitable video, a video for over 18s. It is actually possible. I know it sounds like the ultimate school child excuse.
Yes,
but it is possible to do so.
Huh.
You'd be staggered at how easy it is to type something quite innocent and innocuous into various search engines and get served up with all sorts of inappropriate content.
This report says that the platform, as we now have to call it, X, formerly known as Twitter, is the most common source of the pornography that they're seeing. I've been on Twitter pretty much from its inception. I've never seen any pornography on it at all, not even a hint.
You've not been looking for it, and it's not being shown to you, which is a good thing, probably, I would add. But any flavour of pornography is available on that platform.
Is it?
And yes, and that is the challenge. It's actually become one of the, I think, easiest places to find this content. Some of it you would find by typing in what would be considered innocuous terms in other places that get used for terms to describe things in the world of porn. And some people just post it to different hashtags. If it's a really popular hashtag, some people will post pornographic content to it. So, and back in the old days, the previous owners of the platform would shield this stuff and stop people from seeing it. But Elon Musk doesn't care. And that's the challenge here. It's far easier to see that content and have that content shown to you. And the freedom of showing that content is one of the reasons why X has been quite insistent over the last month or so, since the Online Safety Act came in, of trying to verify that people are over the age of 18, which has caused these incorrect flags for things like people talking about protest and all sorts of other stuff, which have turned the Online Safety Act into the government are trying to take away our freedom of speech, etc., etc., etc.
Well, you said Elon Musk doesn't care. Well, we're not certain about that. Maybe he cares very much indeed. But it's just so prevalent, if what you're saying is right, that it's impossible to take it down, to screen it, to do anything about it.
I would justify my statement as LBC's technology correspondent suggesting that Elon Musk doesn't care by saying that Elon Musk fired the entire team of people that were responsible for keeping this sort of content off of the platform. Right. He's also the person that is freely and openly welcome white supremacists and all sorts of other people back to the platform. So I think he wants an audience, and he wants an audience to click on content. It is a whack-a-mole when it comes to this kind of content. Like I said, some platforms take down porn quite quickly. It then appears on a different hashtag, or the kind of people sharing it in the communities behind various kinks suddenly hijack a different hashtag or use a different term to describe it. So there is this kind of constant battle between the people uploading it and the people trying to, and I'm going to use the term widely, protect people on the internet from it.
These tech companies, they seem lawless, essentially, too powerful to control. And they have Trump in their corner, who reacts very badly when his donors have their freedom to do whatever they want restricted. So is there anything that the British government can do, given that they are desperate to ingratiate themselves with the US president?
That's one of the biggest questions at the moment. For example, there's a kind of a message board on the internet called 4chan, and 4chan is kind of a place for internet pranksters, people who post memes, wannabe hackers, all those kinds of people. And the various bits of unsuitable content gets posted to that platform. Ofcom had written to them recently and said, you're in breach of the Online Safety Act. You need to do this, this, and this. And rather than send back an email or a conversation, they started tweeting various US senators who got incredibly angry that a UK government group was attempting to control a US tech company. And that is the reason why Mark Zuckerberg has gone full MAGA in the last couple of months, because, you know, he is literally wearing the Make America Great Again hat now, because he thinks Donald Trump will stop European and other international governments breathing into the business of what they call American tech companies. Zuckerberg keeps saying he runs an American company. It should be judged by American law, despite the fact that it operates in hundreds and hundreds of countries around the world.
And that is also something that informs the government's current battle with Apple over encryption, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's also been really, really messily handled, in that Apple went public with this. But you have to wonder what was going on with the other tech companies, because all the other tech companies use similar encryption. So Meta used similar encryption. Google used similar encryption. Were there conversations going on behind closed doors, or was Apple targeted for a particular reason? And the government always says, oh, we don't talk about matters of national security and operational importance. But without that clarity, it's hard to know why Apple, who, if you're running a sliding scale about how compliant tech companies are, Apple probably are the most compliant out of all of them in terms of requests, helpfulness, you know, being contactable, etc., etc., etc. So it seems strange that this happened, but that's been overturned today, and that's as direct pressure from the US government on the UK. But we never got to understand, Nick, why the UK government thought it was so important to have it.
Yes. Apart from their addiction to surveillance, and control, which seems to be getting stricter by the day. But this Online Harms Act, I mean, we mentioned that. What effect has that had?
Well, if you talk to the porn companies, Pornhub has seen its traffic drop by 1.5 million users a day in the UK since July. Now, whether or not that means they are now accessing the site via Sweden and not Swindon via a virtual private network, or people are on their summer holidays and not looking at porn, there are several questions to answer. But they have identified that traffic from the UK has decreased, but they are now saying, without evidence, that people are going to find illegal content on the internet so they don't get caught in age gates.
Right. And isn't it true that whatever impediment that the government puts in the way of children accessing anything online, those tech-savvy kids will be able to skip around it quite easily?
Yeah, and something, the Children's Commissioner came out with something today that made me just want to bang my head against a wall as somebody that believes in a lot of what she said and the work that she's done. But she's now talked about the need for the government to police VPNs. These are the virtual private networks that people are using to, like I said, pretend they're in Sweden and not Swindon in order to get access to the internet. And they can be used for all sorts of important reasons. In fact, the government tells its staff to use VPNs for security at home if they're working from home, and various other businesses legally use them. The bigger issue here is not that kids are using VPNs, it's that the government has applied the lowest, or Ofcom has applied the lowest possible standards on the Online Safety Act. Companies like Google, for example, Nick, if you turn up at YouTube and pretend you're in America and you want to watch some content that's only available on YouTube in America, like a new Hollywood movie that's come out or whatever that you can buy there, what you'll get is a message saying, ooh, it looks like you're on a VPN. You'll need to turn that off before you come back and access it. So companies can do more already to detect if somebody is using a VPN. None of those services that Ofcom have recommended to the porn companies have that in their armory at the moment. So it's six of one, half a dozen of the other, in that the government's chosen the weakest or cheapest route and the companies haven't upped and stepped up the security to stop people bypassing age verification with a VPN. It can be better stopped than it is now.
Essentially, what the government is trying to do is ban material that it doesn't like for a certain demographic. Is that not a bit like trying to ban paper because we don't like what's written on some of it?
Right. This is a real mess, because the Online Safety Act was written in such a general way that many bits of it can be over-interpreted, over-engineered, overused, maybe another good way to put it. But outside of my work at LBC, I do a lot of work in the internet safety space, as in working with young people, those kind of things. And I've seen the direct impact that some of this material, that something like the Online Safety Act is trying to block. The challenge you face is, though, if the government developed a spine and introduced some kind of proper national digital ID, which is going to send everybody into meltdown the moment I mention it, you could avoid all of these problems, because you could identify who is 18 and who is not, and you wouldn't have to treat everybody with the same level of suspicion.
Yes. The problem with that, though, is you might be okay with whatever you're looking at as an adult under this current government, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you'll be okay under a subsequent government. And everything that you look at, presumably, is going to go on your permanent record for any future even more authoritarian government to pick and choose as to what they do and do not like.
Yeah, I think you're entirely right, but having seen the impact of self-harm content, pro-suicide content, all sorts of other stuff on young people who shouldn't be getting access to it, and the tech companies haven't really done enough to police it, I kind of feel quite supportive that the government has tried something, but it's just been handled in a really messy way. This whole Online Safety Act is more toxic than 5G or the coronavirus jab now, because people like Farage and Right Said Fred and all sorts of other folk have jumped on this as it's some battle against freedom of speech. Whereas admirably at one stage it was all about protecting young people. Now there may be massive overreach from that now, or you know, it might be so poorly written that anything could be interpreted by future governments, but that definitely was the original intent all those years ago when this was first thought of.
Are we not in some the typical societal panic about sex? Because it seems to me that murder is our number one way to relax. Murder is the basis of afternoon TV detective shows. Pretty much every TV show at night is about murder that's not concerning dancing or cooking. Every film poster that's not a rom-com has got a gun in it. So if kids see sex and or rough sex and are influenced by that, how come they're not going out and murdering people?
Yeah, I think society changes. There was nothing juicier when I was a kid about trying to get a copy of The Exorcist on VHS from France. And that film's now shown, you know, on at 9 p.m. on Channel 4 on a Sunday evening. So I think attitudes change and adjust to all of these kind of things. But there is a strange moral panic. I can't disagree with you over what people are seeing and how it's being discussed. And the biggest problem for me, Nick, is everybody is completely blaming the tech companies rather than saying families need to take a better role in protecting young people. The government needs to do something like those public awareness films you had in the 1970s. You know, don't go into the power station or swim on a full stomach after you've had your lunch or whatever. There needs to be some of that about how to use the internet and how to kind of manage the social impact of this powerful tool that we have. You know, tech is a powerful tool. Most of us have got a computer 80,000 times more powerful than took humans to the moon in our pocket. Like, we don't know how to socially deal with that yet as a society.
Very good to talk to you, Will. Thanks for that. Will Guyatt, LBC's technology correspondent. So you think that this is just the typical moral panic that waves across society, you know, every 10 years or so? It's always something, isn't it? It's either drugs or sex, usually those two things. But precious little about murder. I mean, I'm right about that, aren't I? Murder is our number one form of entertainment. Name me a series on TV that's aimed at adults after 9 o'clock that does not feature murder. I bet you can't. Practically every series, both British and American, on television at all, contains the scenes of murder. So if people aren't influenced by that to go out and murder people, then how come they're influenced by seeing what is described as violent and extreme pornography? How come they're influenced by that and not by this constant diet of killing? 0345 6060 973. And moreover, is it the job of the government to police what children are looking at, or is it more the parents' job? You can text 84850, email nicka@lbc.co.uk, and if you're on WhatsApp, then it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
The road stretches before you, but there's trouble ahead. Stationary cars. You're faced with the McDonald's side mission. Do you, A, join the ever-growing queue, or B, take the next exit and treat yourself to a glorious Mackey's?
Detouring to McDonald's.
Start your side mission today.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. Holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900. That's ADVICE to 78900.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org, assuming you want to get noticed.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yeah, so we're talking about pornography. The proportion of children saying they have seen pornography online has risen in the past 2 years. That's according to a report which also found that most children are likely to have stumbled upon it accidentally. Well, at least that's what they say. Children's Commissioner Dame Rachel D'Souza said that her research is evidence that harmful content is being presented to children through dangerous algorithms rather than them seeking it out. I wonder if, moreover, it's a much bigger problem than pornography. The problem is the addictive nature of social media. Because it does appear that tech companies have captured our children. Not literally, not physically, but certainly mentally. And if it were anything else, if it were a drug that most of the children in this country were hooked on, then, well, the government would probably be sending the army out to deal with the people responsible. But the tech companies are apparently untouchable and absolutely is nothing done about them. 0345 606 0973. West Devon. Hello, Rose.
Oh, hello, Nick. What you just said, I was going to begin, and I didn't actually put this to your lady. I was going to begin with that. First, I think, I wonder if we're being habituated to what's happening to children online. So, sort of inured to the gravity of it. And I was going to, indeed, and to the children killing themselves. And I was going to say that, first of all, the fact of algorithms creating addiction in the brains of children so they have no control over their engagement is abuse. We're taking away a child's autonomy at an earlier and earlier age. But
I think we're taking away their childhood. Because
totally.
It almost seems like a dream now, but kids used to run out of the house and go and play, and, you know, when they felt it was time for tea, then they'd come back and the parents had no contact with them in the meantime, and we had fun when we were outside. Now it seems that the only thing that kids want to do is stare at their phones.
Yeah, because they're addicted. And what are we doing creating addiction? Yeah, I mean, we read Winnie the Pooh, for heaven's sake. But it's a continual act of violence, it seems to me, that's being committed against them. I mean, with violent porn, with executions, beheadings, things that they can see and self-harm sites. And to me, Nick, some things come first. Not killing people comes first. And children not seeing sadistic sex, beheadings, etc., comes first.
But do you think that there's actually a difference between, I've never seen sadistic sex or beheadings, but do you think that there's a difference between seeing that or seeing the exact same thing in a big Hollywood blockbuster? Because pretty much every film out there has got some sort of killing, and it's killing killing without consequence. It's killing without a lot of blood. It's killing without all of the gore and the misery that goes with that. It's just clean, and it's often done as a joke.
Yeah, but one of the things that bothers me about is that you can see actual real life beheadings online. And I think the sadistic porn and all that will be pretty sophisticated. And my point is, and also they're seeing them by themselves in their bedroom.
Right.
But this is trauma. And one way that they will be dealing with it is by simply shutting down feelings to cope, so the whole thing seems normal. To me, the minute a child was exposed to such things online, a measure should have been put through Parliament forbidding devices for under 16s. Of course, that's impossible now. But, you know, adult
haven't Australia done just
come first?
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but haven't...
No, you're right.
Hasn't Australia done just that?
Well, exactly. And now we've got Farage, in effect, declaring our right to see and create porn should prevail over children's need for protection. And the safety bill is then threatening free speech. And the Trump regime has then just said exactly the same thing. So don't tell me they're not in league with each other.
Well, I think it's the other way around. I think Farage just spouts whatever Trump said last.
Yeah, but yes, I suppose he'd already heard it from Trump before Trump told us. I mean, how dare he accuse us? And what's it got to do with him, what our government does? And I heard a concerned voice on radio say, a little while ago, to say, the fact that several children have killed themselves should not be hidden. Hidden? It's being hidden? You know, where is the outrage and where's the flipping priorities? And I mean, this nonsense about free speech. Have you ever in your life heard anything so absurd?
The other side of it, though, is that whatever the government does to try to restrict kids' abilities to, you know, see all this stuff that we're talking about, that's not going to pose an impediment to children. They're way smarter as far as technology is concerned than their parents, or especially the government. They'll skip around any fence that you put in their way. It's not a problem to them. And I think that these porn sites in this country that are saying that they're seeing their traffic drop. I think that is, well, I can't think of any other, you know, the customer numbers fall. I suspect that that's because of these VPN apps or programs, whatever you call them, give people the ability to make it look as though they're not in this country. That's probably the is of it, that there's just as many people looking at the stuff. It's just that they appear to be coming from another country.
My God. No, I mean, it is all too late, isn't it? I mean, how these kids are going to grow up, what their brains are going to be like at the end when they're adults, with social engineering.
It can't be too late. And it's absolutely outrageous that really is saying anything about it. I mean, never mind about the material that we're talking about. Just the fact that they seem so utterly captured by these devices in their pockets that they cannot put them away. The only time I'm ever around kids is in the gym when I haven't got my act together to get out of there before these clouds of haircuts come in and occupy all the equipment. Just sitting there staring at their phones. And it's impossible to get them off. They don't do anything. They don't move. They're just gawping at them. It's infuriating. But if it's infuriating for me, it must be absolutely soul-destroying for them. Because they're utterly murder. Captured.
Yeah, they've murdered them, in effect. You know, because they have no individuality at the end of it, and they have no autonomy, which is such an important word. I mean, when I use that word, just very quickly, talking to a younger friend of mine who'd had God's own struggle to get off addiction, cocaine and alcohol, he said, "My God, what a marvellous word. That's exactly it, because the drugs and the drink controlled me."
Mm-hmm.
And finally, he's free.
And I wonder if
we're controlling these kids from the age of blidden three, aren't we?
And I wonder if being addicted to phones also makes you more susceptible to become addicted to other things in later life.
Yes, it will. I'm an addictive type, you see. That's why I'm desperately steering clear of it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm addicted to anything. I've had to, stern measures have had to be taken to stop me texting.
Well, I support you on your journey to freedom, Rose, and I appreciate that. Thanks. Right, coming up after the news, the Tories are complaining that their party's attack ad on asylum hotels is making them look silly because they're attacking Labour's policies that were introduced by the Conservatives. I'll be speaking with a Spectator columnist to get his thoughts on whether the Conservatives are now left looking like they've run out of ideas. 12:30, right on the nose. The news headlines with Daryl Jackson.
A council in Essex has been granted a temporary injunction to block asylum seekers being housed in a hotel in Epping. There's been ongoing protests outside the Bell, and the district council has concerns about the risk to public safety. Donald Trump's suggested American jets could help defend Ukraine if there is a deal to end the war. But the president has ruled out sending troops as part of a security guarantee after telling reporters the US will be involved in peacekeeping. A man who was driving 140 miles an hour in a 40 zone in North London has admitted killing a woman in a crash on Christmas Day. 32-year-old Evan Ford from Bedford was behind the wheel of a Mercedes which hit the back of a BMW in Brent Cross in 2022. LBC weather, a cloudy start for many this morning, becoming sunnier in the afternoon, especially in the southwest and northwest, a high of 24 degrees.
This is LBC.
Does your summer sound like this? Or is it more like this? At Screwfix, get more garden power from steel. Whether you're pruning and trimming, blasting a patio with a pressure washer, tidying a hedge,
or tackling a tree. We're here to help you get the job done, so you can relax and put your feet up. Shop our biggest ever range of steel on the app, online or in-store at Screwfix.
There are days when you're hungry for McDonald's. Then there are days when you're big arch hungry for McDonald's. You'll get to know the difference. New Big Arch for big McDonald's hunger. Until 9th of September, from 11 a.m. Participating restaurants only, subject to availability.
Get a step closer to winning a huge £20,000. Enter now at winplus.co.uk. WinPlus, great prizes, real winners. 18 plus, GB only, T's and C's apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Conservative MPs have expressed frustration at their parties, what they call poor messaging, over hotels housing people seeking asylum. Leaked WhatsApp messages show Conservative MPs are concerned that the party's leadership is attacking Keir Starmer's government for policies that were introduced by the Conservatives. Let's talk about this with Ross Clark. Ross is an author at The Spectator. Hello, Ross.
Hello, hi.
The Tory leadership criticising Labour for doing the exact same thing that they did while in power. Do they have no memory or no shame?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. That the failure to rein in illegal migration was a very, very big failure of the last Conservative government. The small boats began under the Conservatives. They escalated under the Conservatives. Rishi Sunak scored a minor success in doing a deal with Albania, which reduced migrants from that country in 2023. But otherwise, migrant hotels, you know, that was a Conservative policy to put them in hotels. So, you know, why they should suddenly start attacking Labour for that is a bit ridiculous. I mean, it's true that Keir Starmer's government's made things worse, but, you know, I think either Conservatives, you'd think either they'd keep quiet or they would say, yeah, we made a very, very big error, but this is what we're going to do to put it right. But just to sort of put out attack ads in the way the Conservatives have done, it does rather, you know, raise the eyebrows somewhat.
Yeah, but it would raise our eyebrows. But do you think that most people who would be the viewers of those ads will recognise that fact? Or will they just think, oh, yeah, there is a problem. Labour are in power. Must be Labour's fault.
I don't think voters have that short a memory, really. I think they remember very well the Conservative failures over illegal migration. And I mean, Reform UK is making all the running on migration. It's their issue. And it is going to be very, very difficult for the Conservatives to win, public support for that. I think the opportunity for the Conservatives is more picking up on what is going to become a very, very big fiscal crisis, the overspending by the present government. And Reform UK also have very sort of left-wing, high-spending policies. There's an opportunity there for the Conservatives to get in and say, we are the low-spending party, we are the party that's going to bring the public finances back into order, but not the illegal migration.
Isn't that the exact same problem as the one that we started talking about? Because, you know, this fiscal problem that this country has is surely mostly the fault of the Conservatives, who had their hands on the reins of power for over 14 years.
Yeah, but in the first five of those years, the Conservatives really did shrink the state and start to get public spending under control. What happened then is they lost the focus after the Brexit vote, and then after COVID, and, you know, high spending, big government was in fashion. But I think, you know, back over the years and back over the 14 years of the previous government, actually they did score some successes in reining in public spending. And there's no real strong issue on which the Conservatives have to themselves at the moment, but it's certainly not going to be illegal migration.
I mean, the Conservatives at the moment, they seem dazed. They seem lost. They're becoming a wing of the Farage party, desperate to get some of the support that he appears to attract. You know, those people yelling obscenities and throwing bricks outside hotels, but which don't seem like traditional Tory voters. Do the Conservative Party even know who they're trying to appeal to anymore?
Well, that is very, very difficult at the moment, because we've got something now which we have not had for 100 years, which is a serious challenge from a third party, which, you know, really looks as if it could form the next government. And the Conservatives are in previous parliaments, you know, governments become unpopular and then people turn back to the party that was previously in power. But on this occasion, they are not doing that. They are going to this third party, Reform UK, and it is very, very difficult for the Conservatives to get any traction for that reason, for the simple sort of electoral geometry has changed completely.
What about the personalities? I mean, is it the other party's great good fortune that the Conservatives have chosen yet another leader who is even more awkward and inept than, for instance, Keir Starmer is?
I think, you know, at any other time, Kemi Badenoch might have made a good Tory leader, might have made a good Prime Minister even. I mean, she does have ideas which not all prime ministers have, including the current one. But you're right, she's not a great public performer, and she stumbles in prime ministers' questions. She doesn't really project her personality. That is a drawback. But I'd say the biggest thing is the change of electoral geometry. You know, and we've got, you know, a party now which is... But the Conservatives' hope is that Reform UK is going to start taking votes away from Labour more than it is from the Conservatives. And that's their sort of chink of hope. And they've really got to sort of, you know, think of areas in which they can stand apart from Labour and Reform UK. And I say, the idea of big government, small government, that is one issue where the Conservatives can, create their own identity and claim their own ground. It's not going to pay fruit in the short term, but, you know, the next election could still be the best part of 4 years ago. And in that time, we are highly likely to have a major fiscal crisis, international investors losing total confidence in the ability of the UK government to service and repay its debts. And at that point, the Conservatives could be in a very good position if they, now spin a consistent message on that issue. But illegal migration, they're not going to win that one. Farage is going to win that one.
But they, you know, in order to revivify their fortunes, the Tories are going to have to put forward someone who's likeable. I mean, you said that Badenoch doesn't put forward her personality very well. I'd contest that. I'd say that she's putting forward her personality very well, and it's not likeable at all. I mean, she's boasting about getting children expelled from school, and then Robert Jenrick's on manoeuvres, recording himself bravely questioning people who might have avoided a £2 train ticket with only his security as backup. Do they even realise how unlikable they're coming across?
I think that the main, if you sort of got a focused group together and say what people think of the Conservatives, it would not be so much unlikable. The word that would come up, I'm sure, is irrelevance at the moment. I see the Conservatives as a total irrelevance, because, you know, they're the sort of third party in British politics at the moment. And, you know, just as the Lib Dems have been the third party, were the third party for many years, it's not a very comfortable place to be. But you really have to sort of shout to be heard. You have to, and even when you are heard, it doesn't necessarily provide much luck at the ballot box, particularly at general elections. So, I mean, that's the real problem for the Conservatives, is to avoid becoming the third biggest party at the next election, and to, you know, slip away out of power as the Liberals did 100 years ago.
And that seems to be where they're going, because they appear to be trying to out-Farage Farage, don't they? They're competing with him on his own turf. But Farage has got the similar sort of cult-like grip on his people as does Trump in America. The people that love Farage now, they've gone. They're not coming back. So the Tories are going to have to get... they're going to have to appeal to some other voters. What group is there that might yield results for them?
I think I wouldn't necessarily start thinking of niche groups. I think, as I say, I think there is going to be a very, very big fiscal crisis in the next few years, and that will totally change the tone of political debate in this country. And I think Reform UK could end up on the wrong side of that debate, because Farage and so on have been advocating much higher public expenditure, in some type of ways outflanking Labour in terms of the child benefit, doing away with the two-cap child benefit. I think that is really what you've got to look towards, and what the Tories have to look towards is, you know, things getting so bad and the country ending up like Greece did in 2011, when, you know, requiring emergency loans, probably from the IMF or the EU. We certainly won't get them from the EU, will we? And that necessitating very, very deep cuts to public spending in terms of public pensions, salaries, employment, and so on. You know, that is where we are going. You look at the numbers, the figures, and public borrowing, that is where we are going. The debt is becoming totally insurmountable. It's well over £100 billion a year. You know, we look like having to spend on servicing public debt this year. We've got a spending deficit of £150 billion probably, which is going to, you know, add even more on the debt pile. Interest rates, long-term interest rates are going up as investors. You know, it's worse than it was under Liz Truss. What happened under Liz Truss was just a sort of rehearsal for the much bigger crisis to come. And when it comes, the tone of public debate is going to have to change enormously.
Yes, but
and,
will surely still be...
The Conservatives got to position themselves to take advantage of
that. I can't see how they will manage to do that, because it's everything that you just said is essentially their fault. They are the ones that left Labour with this catastrophe. Labour haven't engineered an economic downturn of themselves in the brief period that they've been in power. They've been wrestling the one that was gifted to them by the Conservative Party, who seem to be in a sort of eddy of whining grievance about it, desperate to blame the brand new government. Essentially, that's what it is. It's hardly had time to stop the ship, let alone turn it around. And in an attempt to get the public to... I mean, I know that we've gone over this, and you don't think that the public will forget. I suspect that they forget immediately. And that's what the Tories are trying to make happen, that we will dismiss or forget or not quite understand the relevance of the Conservatives' lead in the 14 years up to this Labour government. It's their fault.
Do you know, I think the best approach from the Tories at the moment is really to keep quiet and go back and come up with ideas to how to run a country with a much smaller state. That's what they should be thinking of at the moment. And let Labour destroy themselves. Let Reform UK is quite likely to implode, because... Mm.
Well,
you know,
it is in the council. The councils that they're running, they seem to be a clown show.
The biggest problem for Reform UK is going to be the quality of its candidates.
Yeah.
And it's got a charismatic leader. It's got, you know, pretty able was he deputy leader of the president, or Richard Tice? You know, he's a very able figure as well.
Hardly likable, though. I mean, Farage is the man, isn't he?
Well, that's very subjective, obviously.
Yes.
Obviously, there are a lot of people. Farage is a guy who has a lot of charm. He has a lot of personality. However, and he's, you know, he's very able politically as well.
Wily.
But what they have below is trying to create a party from scratch and get, you know, 650 candidates together to make a credible, challenge the next election. That is going to be tough. It's going to be extremely tough. And, you know, the one of the big problems, where they are politically, they inevitably attract quite a lot of unsavoury people on the fringe.
Yes,
and it's not
do.
That I think Farage or Richard Tice are in that category, but they are inevitably going to attract people who are in that category, and they are going to have a hell of a job to weed those people out, because as you get closer to an election, the chances are we will have one embarrassment after another.
Yes.
As their candidates apart,
imploding. Yeah, well, there's something to look forward to. Very good to talk to you, Ross. Thanks very much for your time. That's Ross Clark, author of The Spectator. Now we're going to take a short break, and coming up, we're going to get our roundup of the latest coming out of the United States, including the aftermath of Trump's meeting with Putin and Zelensky, and the possibility of Epstein files being handed to Congress in the coming days.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
Asylum seekers face being removed from the Bell Hotel in Epping after a High Court injunction. But could this set a precedent for the rest of the country? And where on earth will they be sent instead?
Richard Spur on LBC.
There are days when you're hungry for McDonald's. Then there are days when you're Big Arch hungry for McDonald's. You'll get to know the difference. New Big Arch for Big McDonald's hunger. Until 9th of September, from 11 a.m, participating restaurants only, subject to availability.
So, what are you watching at the moment?
Squid Game, Dad.
Let's watch it together this weekend. That'd be nice. What's it on again?
Netflix. You've got EETV, so you just switch it on.
What season are we up to?
4. That's Stranger Things, Mum.
And what about the kids?
Don't worry, they'll watch Cocomelon for the 100th time.
Switch on Netflix with EETV. Plus, change up sports and entertainment. It's TV with the ultimate flex for the whole family.
EETV requires EE broadband. Separate 24-month contracts for TV and broadband. Content may vary, terms apply.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quadrapillar Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot Bears. And 4 giant slides on the brand new Wave Runner 2. Let's plunge!
What's next, Dad?
Cannon Arena Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Trampolines, Magical Wood and Cafes.
Nutcatch Adventure Park.
The sun goes on and on and on and on.
Book now at nutcatch.com.
Ears are great, aren't they? One on each side of your head for stereo. It's because of ears that radio ads can amplify your advertising. 40 million adults listen to commercial radio every week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
And I'm joined on the line by John Christopher Buer, White House correspondent for Real Political News. Hello, John.
Hey, nice to be with you at a different time this week, but... look forward to always being with you, Nick. You know that.
Yes, and me too. Likewise, you are talking to us from Washington, D.C., I understand.
Yes, you are.
And until a few days ago, it was apparently the world's most dangerous city. You're lucky to be alive.
I'm lucky to be talking to you, and I'm lucky to be alive. And this is not the world's most dangerous city. I've never had a problem in this town. And, he can hype that up all he wants. So he can become the major general of he's never been in the armed services, by the way, and this is where he gets his himself going. But the fact is, it's not a terrible crime city at all, and he's just doing that. And in fact, it's causing some problems by having the National Guard and the Homeland Security and the FBI and our wonderful police force that we have here under the leadership of Mayor Bowser. And we have a beautiful, you should come over, beautiful, safe city. You know, I don't want to cast aspersions on my friends in Tennessee, but Memphis is much more dangerous, and other cities are much more dangerous. And this is our nation's capital. We have to keep it looking good. So my suggestion is, you know, let's clean up the streets and let these military folks go back and serve their country otherwise.
I appreciate the invitation, but I'm going to have to decline while the current administration is in office.
I don't blame you, but I would come over with a Stommer. You know, I'd come over in a flash.
Okay. I hear that Donald Trump doesn't like any figures that disagree with the last thing that he said, and that violent crime is apparently down 27% in Washington in 1 year. Robbery is down 30%, but he doesn't like those figures, so he's going to make up his own.
Well, he has a habit of doing that. We've discussed that before. He doesn't have the sense of truth and a sense of reality. And I'll tell you, this... The most unpopular law that's passed since 1900 is this big, beautiful bill thing that he's got. The people don't like it. The people, the American people, it is hurting them. The economy and his tariffs have been reduced. The labor force is crashing the economy because the tariff is putting a real bind on the people who are trying to buy things. And guess what? Christmas is coming. The goose is getting fat. And no one's going to have any money to buy anything because the tariffs are killing them.
And this is really starting to show in polling, isn't it? Because he is underwater. I mean, this time during Biden's premiership, I think he had something like a 60% approval rate, and Trump's is in the tank. It's like below 50%.
Well, he's having different problems, and it didn't help him in Anchorage, Alaska, when he met with the man who he is servile to, the way he praises Vladimir the thug Putin, and he just he was said he's going to be very severe if he doesn't come across with a ceasefire. He's going to be very severe, and he's going to get him with the tariffs, and who knows, he might now that's all off the table. He said, and to your prime minister and to Macron and the others who were really quite amazing. I saw them at the White House yesterday, and they had quite a meeting, and they're to promote and help and support Zelensky, because let's face it, Putin just wants to take back Crimea and all of Ukraine. He is like the Tsar coming back. Imagine the Tsar and Stalin in one guy. I always was saying that about Putin, and that's what he wants to be. Somehow, Trump, like George Bush, who took back what he said, I can look into his eyes and I can see his soul, and he's an honest man. You know, Donald Trump always, I don't want to get into what they're looking into, but Donald Trump always backs down to Putin, and he fears and idolizes him. This is a very strange relationship, and I don't think your show's late enough to be able to talk all about it.
Well, it was particularly noticeable that Trump's demeanor after he had that meeting with Vladimir Putin, because he went in all cheesy, grinning and thumbs up, you know, doing his Trump's routine. And he came out and he looked like he'd been used as a punch bag.
Well, he was. And he'll deny it. And they'll come out and say it never happened. In the meantime, there's a real crisis. And he met with him. He fell under his spell. He says he loves strong men, and he gave him multiple wins, and he welcomed him on his soil, and he looked like a deer in the headlights, and it was sad. I mean, you can tell I'm not crazy about this fellow, but he is the president of my country. I mean, you know, I wasn't different fans of different people, but I have to tell you, I feel bad for the American people because we're stuck with this guy at least until 2008, I believe. If
2028.
Excuse me, says that. I'm living in the past. wishful thinking. No, he's and we'll see what happens when the Senate and the House are up for grabs in 2026, which is not so far away. But you know, it seems that Trump forgot his mission. He left saying that the meeting with Putin, no ceasefire. He's now wiped that off. He doesn't know where what he wants to do. He says, we're going to do a lot of swaps. We're going to trade. This is not New York City real estate. This is the world crisis ready to go with Putin. And you've got a guy like Zelensky. Talk about the Nobel Prize. Trump thinks he's going to win the Nobel Prize. Peace Prize. But world peace is on the line. I got to tell you something. Zelensky's got more of a chance of getting that Nobel Peace Prize. And he's jealous because Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize before he was even in the Oval Office, before he was even president, or back in the very beginning, I should say, the very beginning. And he's really upset about that.
I saw a cartoon the other day of the scene in the Nobel Peace Prize office when they were deciding who to give it to. And one of them said, let's just give it to Obama again for giggles.
Yeah, right. He would die. That would take, he would be out. He would be on his way out if that happened. I mean, he is very, very clear about how he feels about things, except one thing. He doesn't know what's going on. And I have to say, it doesn't give me much pleasure to know that my president is not aware. You know, Biden was on the ball. He knew international politics. We had, you know, G.H.W. Bush, George Bush, Obama, my God, and Clinton. I lived through JFK and Ike and Nixon. Nixon's looking good.
By comparison, yeah.
Never thought I'd say that.
Yes. The thing that Donald Trump wants to go away more than anything else is this Epstein thing. And yet, what's happening?
Well, the Epstein thing, I'm afraid, that's the albatross, I should say, around his neck. And that's not going away because he's being plagued by that. And the fact is that he can't get rid of that. And there's more things coming out this week. And there's more information being disseminated by the Department of Justice that is coming out. And there's a lot of information in there, and possibly a lot of people who are being named. And they talk about naming names. That's coming out, and I think he's going to have to be holding on to his hat because, you know, the fact is that we don't know exactly what there is, but we know there's a lot of things. And, you know, when you think about it, it's something that people can relate to. Women can relate to it, certainly. This is about molesting and kidnapping young girls. That's just amazing. And, you know, the GOP Congress is holding hearings, and not much real information seems to be coming out yet, but it will. And I think that's going to be the problem. And Trump is done all of the international peacemaking to distract from Epstein. He's done all the stuff across the world to distract from Epstein. But you know, this has really got him under the collar. And Epstein, who's dead, and we all don't know how he died. They say he killed himself. Mm. Well, that's to be TBD, right? But I think I'm looking at a picture now of Putin in the car. And Trump invited him into his limo. And he rode around the airport in Anchorage, and it was really quite astounding to watch this. Now Putin and Trump and Zelensky, I guess, have to figure out if they have a bilateral or a trilateral. That's a far fetched one. Where are they going to have it? I mean, there's many countries that Putin can't go to.
Well, yes,
he's considered a war criminal.
Yeah, almost all of them. John, I'm going to have to leave it there because I've just run out of time, but great to talk to you, as always. Thanks for that. John Christopher Buer, White House correspondent for Real Political News. Now, if you have missed any part of this super show, you should be aware that it is available for listening on catch-up on both Global Player and the new LBC app, where you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. You can get it for free from your app store now. I'll be back tonight at 10. Coming up at 4, it's Ian Payne. First, Richard Spur.
Morning, Nick, and good morning to you. Still to come, a Tory policing chief has said that the number of the member of the public has a duty to stand up to shoplifters rather than relying on the police. But as a woman who was punched in the face in a branch of Tesco for reporting the crime tells LBC of her PTSD, do you agree? But first, asylum seekers are due to be removed from the Bell Hotel in Epping after the local council was granted a temporary High Court injunction blocking them from being housed there. Thousands of people have protested near the hotel in recent weeks, with an asylum seeker living there being charged with sexually assaulting a 14-year-old girl in the town. So this morning, could the eviction of asylum seekers from hotels now become a precedent across the country? And where does that leave the government when it comes to finding somewhere to put them?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, it's claimed other councils in England are considering legal actions over asylum hotels after a council in Essex secured a temporary High Court injunction. The Bell Hotel in Epping has until September the 12th to stop housing migrants following weeks of violent protests. Reform UK leader Nigel Farage has indicated the 12 councils, where they're the largest party, are also considering legal challenges. Holly Whitbread is a Conservative councillor for Epping and told LBC News she'd encourage that.
If other councils feel that they've got a planning case with a significant change of use, I would encourage them to do the same. Obviously, this is also going to make the government look more broadly at how they deal with the illegal immigration crisis and the use of hotels. The use of hotels is hugely expensive and has a massive impact on the communities which they are located in.
Donald Trump's reined back on his ability to end the conflict in Ukraine following historic talks at the White House with Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders. The president's ruled out putting US troops on the ground while warning that Russia's Vladimir Putin might not want to secure a peace deal. Egyptian and Qatari mediators are waiting on Israel's response to a new ceasefire proposal in Gaza that's been accepted by Hamas. It would see a 60-day truce and 28 hostages returned in exchange for 200 Palestinian prisoners following the 2023 October the 7th attacks. Reviews suggested there's consistent evidence children who vape are three times more likely to go on to become smokers. Experts analysed all available reviews on youth vaping. They also identified links with increased odds of respiratory illness and substance abuse. John Dunn from the UK Vaping Industry Association told LBC he's not convinced.
If you look at the national numbers, both here in the UK and around the world, shows that youth vaping is declining. It's declining far faster while vaping was increasing. So it doesn't show that vaping is a gateway into smoking.
And the floor space of a typical flat or detached home in England has decreased over the last decade. Research from Nationwide Building Society says the average apartment is now 60.3 square metres, which is a near 2% drop on the typical size in 2013. LBC weather, a cloudy start for many later this morning, becoming sunnier in the afternoon, especially if you're in the southwest or the northwest, a high of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Richard Spur.
Good morning. As you have been hearing, asylum seekers face now being removed from an Epping hotel after the council there was granted a High Court injunction. This is the Bell Hotel. And you will remember that in the weeks gone by, there have been protests there which caused enormous concern and disturbance locally. Many police had to go and deal with them. This was after local people made their voices very, very loudly heard after an asylum seeker living in that hotel was charged with sexually assaulting a 14-year-old girl in the town. The question now, of course, is could this ruling set a precedent, and will other councils across the country, in response to their local people's wishes, approach their local courts and attempt to get asylum seekers evicted too? What will that mean for the government and its
it still says, interim plan to house asylum seekers in hotels up and down the country. What will now be the next stage? And do you welcome the ruling that the court has handed down? Well, nobody knows quite what is going to happen now, but it looks like it's very likely that they will be removed from the Bell there in Essex after that temporary High Court injunction blocking them from being housed there. LBC's Bryony Williams has more.
After an extraordinary day at the High Court in London, Epping Forest District Council has been granted an interim injunction preventing migrants being accommodated at the Bell in Epping. This is despite a last-ditch attempt by the Home Office to intervene. Edward Brown KC, a government legal representative, tried to argue because of the Home Office's statutory obligation to house asylum seekers, the temporary injunction should be dismissed. But Mr Justice Eyre said it would be a waste of court time to hold another hearing, and it was too late for the Secretary of State to intervene at this particular time in proceedings, and they should have acted quicker if they wanted their evidence to be presented. So after around 2 hours of court proceedings, Mr Justice Eyre granted Epping Council its temporary injunction. And instead of that 14-day timeline that was initially set out, which would have taken us to the beginning of September, we now have the date of September 12th to work to. So asylum seekers staying at the Bell Hotel now face being moved out before that September 12th date. The lawyers for Somani Hotels Limited, which owns the Bell Hotel in Epping, tried to challenge the decision, but this was refused. But they could still go through the Court of Appeal. The Home Office says we will carefully consider this judgment. As this matter remains subject to ongoing legal proceedings, it would be inappropriate to comment further at this stage. Speaking outside the court, the leader of Epping Forest District Council, Chris Whitbread, reacting to the announcement, said this is only the start of a process and subject to appeal. We recognise that, but all things being equal, the Bell Hotel will be empty by September 12th. And that's really important for the students, residents, businesses of Epping Forest. And he also urged people not to gather outside the hotel to celebrate or protest. So a fairly muted victory, but a victory nonetheless.
Well, Councillor Chris Whitbread, the leader of the Epping Forest District Council, spoke to Sky News.
Long has been talk to us and let's move this forward. We always knew the Bell Hotel was the wrong location because of its close proximity to schools and other parts of the community. It was never going to work out, and we did repeat that to them on several occasions.
Does this set a precedent? What is your message to other councils across the UK looking at this as an example of what they could do?
Well, the important thing for other councils is every council must look at their own planning policies and the reasons behind what's happening. So I would say to every council, consider your own planning policies. This is not a victory today. This is a ruling for common sense.
And finally, Councillor, what is your message to the protesters in Epping who may well see this as you say, a victory or a small step in the right direction? What's your message to them? And did you take into account their strength of feeling when you went about this case?
I took into account the strength of feeling of residents in Epping Forest. My local people have been contacting me directly and discussing this issue over the recent weeks, and I've been on the side of local people from day one. That's the most important thing. Yes, if people continue to want to protest or demonstrate outside the Bell, please do it peacefully and please do it calmly. What we don't want is to have people thinking this is some great victory today. This is just a judgment for common sense.
Now, of course, what this may well do is to embolden other councillors